Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Revision Energy. Sunbug Solar is now part of Revision Energy, a solar installer committed to being a renewable energy partner for New England and working to fight climate change. Learn more at sunbugsolar.com.
This is Boston Public Radio. Today we're bringing you some of our favorite conversations about food, cooking, and the policies that go behind how and what we eat. We kick things off with Joanne Cheng, the James Beard Award-winning pastry chef behind Flower Bakery. And she joined us last year to talk about her book, Pastry Love, A Baker's Journal of Favorite Recipes.
Well, I think every time I've written a book, I've had a very specific purpose. I'm going to write about all of the recipes at Myers & Chang, or I'm going to write a baking book with less sugar. And with this book, I wasn't planning on writing a book. My editor said, I really think you should write a Bible. And I said, gosh, I don't have what it takes to write a Bible. And I said, but I do have all of these baking journals, and maybe if I knit them and stitch them all together, I could come up with a baking book. And so basically that's...
What do you mean a baking journal?
Just like, at this point, it's physical journals, it's online notepads, just whenever it's on my Instagram, you know, things that I take pictures of. Whenever there's something that I'm interested in, I jot it down and I test it or I play around with it at work, or sometimes at home. And so I just compiled all of these various journals together.
So we are fully aware, based on your husband, who happens to be Christopher Myers, comments, that if he were you instead of you, he would tell nobody his secrets. He's a very, very selfish person. That's pretty obvious.
No.
He's not?
Absolutely
not. Oh, that's what I heard
not.
From somebody.
He is the opposite of that.
Okay, he may be. But there is a point to Christopher's, it's an early quote in the book,
right,
that you're sort of letting your
giving
secrets
away all
out.
The secrets.
Yeah, but
yeah.
That
has never crossed my mind. No,
really?
I mean, Christopher mentions it from time to time. He's like, really? You're going to put that one in there too? I don't feel like there's any secrets. And at least to running and operating a bakery, it's so much more than just the recipes. I mean, the recipes are definitely a component, but it takes so many other things to go into it. So if I can share the recipes and you all can make these things at home and enjoy them, then to me that's wonderful, because it's spreading what I love, which is making great things.
I don't think Joanne has to worry about that much, because not everybody's going to be able to make these things
I knew you were going to say that. When Joanne, with Pastry Love, which is her new book, which is fabulous, and by the way, I don't know anything about baking, and I've been fairly successful, I should say here. I made those chocolate chip cookies
that's
when
right.
you were on TV.
Very successful.
How were they? Tell the truth.
They were fabulous.
Raise your right hand when you say this.
I swear to God.
They were fabulous.
They were perfect.
And they also even looked unlike
looked
what
just
I did
like the
today.
Book.
They looked like your thing. Before you get to what we bake, what did you bring that's from the cookbook?
So I brought the Simple Lemon Spiral, which is
delicious.
In front of you. And then I have our brown butter cinnamon rolls with cream cheese frosting. Currant oats spelt scones. Those are Christopher's favorite. Double chocolate and rye cookie, and then our breakfast cookie, which is like a healthy way to start the day.
Can mere mortals make most of these things? The
Absolutely.
Couple of recipes I've chosen were fairly simple. Like the stuff you brought there. Can an average person that's got a brain do this?
For sure. The currant scone, the double chocolate cookie, and the breakfast cookie, for sure. The cinnamon roll takes a couple of days, and it does take some patience. The lemon spiral also takes a couple of days and takes a little bit of patience. So what really you have to have is the desire to make these things. And if you have that desire, it'll give you the patience to stick through with the recipe.
You know, I can tell you as a novice, the joy of having something at the end of the process work is really, it's thrilling.
It's amazing.
Actually, it's really,
exactly. It's thrilling.
So how many sticky buns did you sell last year in your stores?
Oh, gosh.
Roughly.
Is it a million? Is it a quarter of a million?
Wow.
It feels like a million.
Okay, so
you know,
but literally.
One other thing, too, that I
want to stay on sticky buns for
a
second.
Go ahead.
I did calculate it.
But you changed your recipe, didn't you? From what I understand, didn't you move to cider or something?
Oh, no, that's in the book. We did a variation, apple cider sticky buns.
And what's the difference between the pecan or whatever?
Exactly.
Is the
regular sticky buns are made with pecans, and the apple cider ones, we took out the pecans, we added chopped apples, and then we also, the goo, which is what makes the sticky bun so sticky, is made with honey, brown sugar, butter, and cream, and we took out some of the cream and added cider.
You talk about how you have to fluff.
Oh, my God.
What is that?
Sorry, what is this yellow thing with the
Oh, that's the cinnamon roll.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, brown butter cinnamon roll with cream cheese frosting.
I can make that if I apply myself.
Yes.
Okay, go
absolutely.
Ahead.
Absolutely.
But it's true. You have to, the fluffing of the stand. Now, explain that.
So pastry love, which is the name of the book, is also a term at the bakery that we use all of the time. And it refers to looking at the pastry counter and, as you said, fluffing it up a little bit and making it look beautiful so that when the guest walks in, they see the bounty of all the pastries.
Yeah. I mean, that's a big deal. You don't want a lot of, like, spaces or
right.
things to be messy or, you know, somebody's removed all the sticky buns and then you see all the goo sitting there
right.
by itself. I mean, that's a really big deal.
Right.
I love that.
By the way, this is from a woman, Joanne, who has every piece of paper she's used in the show spewed
okay.
all over.
I know.
Okay. So, okay. Joanne, here's the moment of decision. Now,
would you hand me the box, please?
Yes, I will. But in the interim, so what we chose, because we decided to make the same thing, and
yes.
we decided we'd have we're not going to tell you who made which.
Okay.
You're going to taste both of these.
Okay.
Is that okay with you? You
of
look
course.
Like there's a lot of trepidation.
To.
Now, they don't look exactly. I told you when you walked in here, we chose the ham and cheese puff.
Yes.
Last night, I was carrying them to my car, and my cross-street neighbor said, what are you doing? I said, Joanne Chen's coming on. She's a huge fan of yours. She doesn't know you, but she knows Flower and Myers and Chang. And she took the recipe and called me this morning and said, not only do they taste great, which I think ours do, but they looked exactly like the cookbook. Ours do not look exactly
okay.
like the cookbook. So first you're going to do a taste
yes.
and judge them, and then you're going to tell us what we did wrong.
Okay.
Is that fair enough?
Yeah,
okay.
yeah, totally.
Now, we're not going to tell you who's who.
Okay.
This is the first one. They look a little, oh, look at the look on her face, a little pancake-like. This is, by the way,
like
Joanne
puffs.
Beard, who won, Joanne Chang, who won the James Beard Award Best Baker in America.
Okay.
She's about to taste one of ours thing. It looks like a pancake kind of thing.
It does look like a pancake.
Okay. It's supposed to look like a puff.
Can you judge that, please, for us?
Well,
oh, this is a problem.
The flavor is good.
Oh, okay.
Flavor's good.
Yeah.
I taste the ham and the cheese, but
however.
It's this is a made with tapioca flour. It's a gluten-free ham and cheese puff that is like supposed to be really chewy and delicious.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a little bit rubbery and a little flat, and it looks like a pancake, so it's not quite right.
Okay, can you taste this one?
Yes.
We're not saying who made the okay. pancake-looking one or that much more attractive one.
We
won't say who made that one.
These look better.
They do.
Mm-hmm.
And how would you say the taste?
And they taste better. They're still not quite exactly. They're supposed to be a little bit lighter.
Lighter.
A little bit hollower.
So
okay.
before we get to
okay.
what
right.
we
so
did
Jim
wrong,
won.
Excuse me. Which are the preferred ones again?
She already said.
I think these are these.
Yeah.
Are these
I'm
yours?
Sorry,
are
Marjorie.
Gyms.
Whose are
those?
Those are Jim's. Okay, fine. Okay, now what did we do wrong? Now I know you know what Marjorie did wrong. By the way, why don't you tell her what you screwed up?
Well,
this is humiliating.
I had difficulty finding the tapioca flour.
Well, that's not the issue. Go ahead.
And when I finally found the tapioca flour, it was later in the evening. So I made that at about 7 o'clock,
mm-hmm.
and then I realized. And I learned a lesson. You should read through the whole recipe. I did not have a standing mixer with
okay.
a paddle attachment.
Listen to what she used.
So I put them in the Cuisinart, which probably was a mistake.
That's sad.
Hence the pancakes.
So, okay, so I actually had a mixer. What did I – I mean, the taste is pretty close to what it's supposed to be, yes?
Yes, the taste is close. Do you have a kitchen scale?
I do.
Okay, so you weighed everything?
I did.
You used tapioca flour, not tapioca starch?
I did.
When you mixed it, what was the consistency after you added all of the ingredients?
I thought exactly like you described in the
scrambled
thing,
eggs.
Like scrambled eggs.
Yeah, like, okay.
Yeah, I love the look.
So then you scooped and then you baked?
I did, yeah.
Was your oven set at the right temperature?
Oops.
350.
But did you put it in and then turn on the oven?
Actually, it was not at 350.
Was
it supposed to be 350?
I think so.
What's a convection oven?
Convection oven adds air to the inside of the oven cavity.
So is that better when you're baking or does
it
matter?
It just bakes a little bit more evenly. But all of these recipes were tested in traditional home ovens without convection.
So
yours are better.
Okay, fine. Mine are better, right?
Much better.
Now,
mm-hmm.
have you ever seen anything quite as sad as Marjorie's pancake there? That's not a ham and cheese puff. That's ham and cheese pancake. I mean, is that?
Well, it looks like an arepa.
By the way, Joanne Chang is one of the nice people on the planet. For her to say anything critical about, and it,
I'm trying to be factual.
Now, my experience with you, because I am a nervous cook and baker, as I've told you through the years, is confidence is a pretty important element to be able to pull
yes.
any of these things off. So what's your advice to someone who does have trepidation? I'm serious, when they start the process.
Absolutely.
So they can get through it.
I think you should read the recipe from the beginning to the end and visualize every part of it so that you make sure that you have the right ingredients, so that you make sure that the oven is on at the right temperature, so that you have the right equipment, so that you're not in the middle of the recipe kind of flailing about wondering what to do and then taking a shortcut.
But you know what? Excuse me, we've got something very important.
What's that?
This is why Joanne Chang is a genius and you should get her cookbook, because when I called you up, I said, these are gluten-free. Do you realize these are gluten-free?
I didn't until you
and
told me.
And I have an aversion to gluten-free
so
things.
Do I
don't like them. You know something? Mine do look like pancakes. There's no question about it. But they don't taste that.
Right.
I mean,
it's
so
not that
created,
aftertaste or
you
something.
You have created a gluten-free recipe that doesn't taste like
exactly.
a gluten-free recipe.
How so?
How?
Well, so there are a lot of pastries that are naturally gluten-free that don't use gluten-free flour. A lot of gluten-free flours, which are meant to be substituted for a regular all-purpose flour, contain flours that are gluten-free but that have a funny little aftertaste. Or there might be some little additive to the gluten-free flour that makes it act like flour but then does give you that weird taste. In this particular recipe, it is a naturally gluten-free recipe. Because instead of using flour, you use the tapioca flour.
Yeah.
What gives you the greatest joy in your baking world?
In my it's similar to what you just said. When you make something and it comes out great and then you share it with people and as you said earlier, it's thrilling. It's thrilling to see how people can take something that you've made and it makes their day better. And we talk about this a lot at the bakery, that people come in and you have no idea what's been going on, you know, before they walk through the doors, but then you give this a wonderful experience and a great pastry, and they walk out with a smile on their face, and there's no better feeling.
Yeah, pastry. I mean, I'm a big pastry. I love to eat pastry. I mean, it's just something that makes me so happy.
Exactly.
About, like a great chocolate chip cookie, which you also have in your, which is easier. I think I could do that. And
mine, by the way, when I made them, did they not look exactly like yours?
Like the picture.
They
yes.
were amazing.
They were
yeah.
crispy,
say so myself.
Buttery. Yes.
Now, but that's it. It's just wonderful. It just
can I put
makes
this
you
in
so
context,
happy.
If I may, for a second?
Yes, Jim.
Just because I don't want Marjorie to feel bad that you said those were maybe the worst things I've ever eaten.
I did not say that.
Well, it was something like that. I can't remember the exact words. Is we had a couple of years ago, Joanne Chang, we had, her book is Pastry Love, which is spectacular. And by the way, the photographs, what's the woman's name again?
Kristen T.
They are gorgeous. They
Thank
are really
you.
Terrific. A couple of years ago, we had a devil egg contest that I was the judge. It was Jared Bowen, our entertainment guy.
Okay, here we go.
Callie
Let's
Crossley.
Just rub it in, Jim.
And
Let's
Marjorie.
Just rub
no,
it
but
in.
No, there's more to the story. And what did you come in out of three?
I lost.
You came in last.
I came in
you
last.
You didn't just lose. However, about 15 years ago, Joanne Chang, on another station, we had a tuna fish challenge between Mike Barnicle and Marjorie Egan.
That's right. I won that
It was
one.
Judged by the late Will McDonough, the sports columnist from the Boston Globe, and you won it in about 10 seconds.
Well, that's because Mike Barnicle made a tuna fish sandwich with no mayonnaise and no kind of substitute. It was like
just
a diet
tuna sitting
tuna.
On a piece of toast.
Dry tuna.
Horrible. Yeah, I that's right. I make very good tuna fish.
Okay,
I,
can we get back to me for a second, please? Joanne, if you had to pick the first three recipes, I'm going to get back to this confidence thing because my confidence is building here. What are the first two or three things you would suggest someone do who's nervous like I am about baking, where it's likely that they're going to have a little success?
I would start with one of the scones. I think the scones are relatively straightforward and easy to make, and if you read the recipe from start to finish and make sure you have all the ingredients, you'll come up with a flaky, buttery, delicious scone.
What else?
The cookies, I think
cookies
you did.
Were pretty
yeah,
easy.
I think
yeah,
most of great. The cookies are very straightforward. Some of the cakes are really straightforward. Any of the cake recipes, that's one-stop shopping. It's like one recipe. You could do one of those and not be worried about coordinating among different recipes.
Fair enough.
And it doesn't matter whether you do convection or not convection. I thought that was a big deal.
Well, it matters a little bit. If you're using convection, you need to reduce the heat of the convection oven a little bit because it acts a little bit hotter. Even though it's the same temperature, it acts a little hotter because the air is
So that's
around.
Why when you turn the convection oven on to 350, it only said 325.
Probably, right.
So let me one last thing about this. How long have you been doing what you're doing? How long, roughly?
Since 94.
Okay, so that's roughly 25 years. Have you ever seen anything quite like that pancake? That's what
I just got a very supportive email from Art.
What did Art say?
Says, Marjorie, you're the best. How many big media stars, I guess he thinks I'm a big media star, thank you, Art, would subject themselves to this kind of abuse? And why do I think Jim Browdy got some outside help with his. Thank you, Art from West Bridgewater. I love you.
Maybe I did. Maybe I
did. You get Smile Side help with yours?
No, I did not. Oh, okay. I really, in all seriousness, I found this to be huge fun.
We were talking to Joanne Chang about her book, Pastry Love, A Baker's Journal of Favorite Recipes. Joanne Chang is a James Beard Award-winning pastry chef who runs Flower Bakery and Myers & Chang along with her husband, Christopher Myers. Up next, recovering fisherman Bren Smith talks about his book, Eat Like a Fish. He's next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, we're replaying some of our favorite conversations about food, cooking, and food policy. We pick things up with former commercial fisherman, Bren Smith, about his book, Eat Like a Fish.
So yeah, I was born and raised in Newfoundland, and you know, my heroes weren't astronauts and cowboys. Right? They were fishermen, and I'd look out in the horizon in the morning, and they were heading out to sea, they owned their own boats, had self-directed lives, and sort of had that pride of helping feed the country, right? And so, you know, I've always looked for a profession that, you know, we can still write songs and sing songs about, right? And I think this era of climate change, if we're going to create a new economy, those are the jobs we want. We don't want just like junky jobs. We want ones with meaning. So headed out to sea when I was 14, was on Grand Banks, George's Banks, actually worked at a Lynn here for a bunch of years on lobster boats, and then headed in the, ended up in the Bering Sea. And over time, I went on this sort of search for sustainability and ended up in the urban sea of Long Island Sound.
Well, you talk about how you realize at some point that this was like industrial fishing that was really doing great damage mm-hmm. to the fishing stock and the ocean.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, in Newfoundland, it was a beautiful artisanal fishery. But when I went to the Bering Sea, it was the height of industrialization. So tearing up entire ecosystems with our trawls, they're chasing fewer and fewer fish out to sea, planes, helicopters. I mean, it was way too efficient. Now, I love that job, right? Like sort of the humility of being in 40-foot seas and sort of the solidarity of working with folks. But it just wasn't sustainable. Most of the fish I had was going to McDonald's for the fish sandwich. So here I was tearing up the ecosystem and just producing some of the lowest quality food on the planet.
Did it ever occur to you in all these years you might want to learn how to swim? I mean, did that ever like cross your mind, Bren,
well,
or no?
A lot of northern fishermen don't know how to swim.
Is that really so?
We just say it prolongs your death. Like, you know, you're going to fall in. Just like calm down, say goodbye, right?
We're talking to Bren Smith. His book is Eat Like a Fish, and I should say My Adventures as a Fisherman Turned Restorative Ocean Farmer.
You know, just one little detail that I read about Newfoundland is that people had...
Newfoundland,
excuse me, that people had all these different colored, brightly painted houses. Tell people why.
Yeah, so, you know, in the town I was from, it was the most eastern point in all of North America, bolted to rocks, and the houses were like pinks, greens, oranges, reds, mostly painted with leftover boat paint, right, so we could find our way home through the fog.
I love that.
That's great. Yeah. So tell us what you do. We figured out how you got here. And also, there was a hurricane or two in the midst of this that converted you into the new you. Describe what the new you is doing there, Bren.
Well, I got to tell you, moving from a hunter-gatherer to an ocean farmer was not easy, right? I mean, you know, I lived on adrenaline. And ocean farmers, you know, it's kind of boring. It's being like an arugula farmer. I can't hang out in the same bars as I used to, right? What am I going to say? Like, there was this huge piece of kelp, biggest I've seen in years. Like, I'd be kicked out, right? So, but it's been an important transformation. So what I'm doing now is we call restorative ocean farming and growing things that don't swim away and you don't have to feed. So when you begin looking at the ocean as a unique agricultural space, there's two things you see. One is you don't really have to fight gravity. So you don't need pens and buildings and things. You just need ropes and buoys. And you can grow zero input food, things that don't need water, fertilizer, feed, land, making it the most sustainable food on the planet. Now, the farm, if you were to imagine it, think of it sort of as an underwater garden. You've got anchors and then vertical ropes up to the surface. There are buoys there. And then about 8 feet below that, you've got horizontal ropes. And from there, we grow our seaweeds vertically downwards, our mussels and mussel socks, scallops, and then oysters in cages, and then clams down in the mud. And the idea is just you know, to grow as many things as we can. And I think it's just the beginning. There are 10,000 plants in the ocean, right? And there are hundreds of kinds of shellfish. And so suddenly, imagine being a chef, and there are arugulas, kales, corns that you've never tasted or cooked with before. So suddenly all this sort of depressing news about climate change and the fact that, you know, 70% of fresh water is used for agriculture, you know, all this sort of doom and gloom. Well, this could be a sort of beautiful, great cuisine.
Why is it one of the things when I was reading about vertical farming, as you wrote about it, I understood the no fresh water thing, which is great. No fertilizer thing, which is great. It takes up smaller spaces, obviously, by definition, because it's vertical as opposed to horizontal. What I didn't understand is how it's hurricane-proof or weather-proof. And you used, I don't know if you used that exact term, but used that concept. Why is it?
Yes, so the key is to be a willow, not an oak, in the ocean, right? So the storms come through, and you just bend with it, right? So your buoys actually don't stay on the surface. They sink. Your lines just bend, and then you pop back up after the storm. And that took a while to learn for me, and I got destroyed by a couple of hurricanes. But over time, you know, if you farm every day, you're just asking the ocean, okay, what makes sense? What should we grow, and how should we do it?
Also, didn't you just say that the growth rate of things, I don't know if it's just kelp, but seaweed in general, is what, 20, 30 times as fast as other plants? Is that not what you said?
Yeah, it's kelp specifically. It's one of the fastest growing plants on Earth, and it's called the sequoia of the sea. Right? It soaks up 5 times more carbon than land-based plants. One reporter called it the culinary equivalent of the electric car. Right? So here we can grow delicious food. We have to make it delicious. Let's be, you know, when I started this, I was like, seaweed is disgusting, right? It's embarrassing to grow and gross, right? But over time, there's a transformation of me in the book of understanding that there's this whole sort of set of miroirs in the ocean and this whole sort of journey of cuisine. The other thing we discovered was it's not just Asian. There's a whole lost Western culinary history of seaweeds. So, you know, indigenous peoples ate it all the time. They smoked it, fermented it, had herring roe with it. It was a delicacy. It was a bar snack at Irish pubs and with Scots. Italians used it in both pastas, and Germans turned it into fritters, fermented it. Like, there is a whole cuisine that was sitting there.
But that's part of your challenge, is it not? Mm. I mean, you can say that and be intellectually honest, retelling history. You've got to convince. I mean, the challenges that seem from having read your book and read about you.
With all those recipes in the back.
Is you may be moving too quickly in some ways. We're going to talk in a minute about whether the infrastructure is there, but beyond just the infrastructure, which you'll describe what the needs are and how expensive it is the desire there. Because my assumption is the average person listening to the show probably does a sushi kind of thing. Yeah. And, you know, nori's okay. I'm used to that. Yeah. But kelp? What am I going to do with kelp kind of thing? So there's a huge public education aspect to this deal, right?
Absolutely. And there's always been a challenge. I don't want to oversell this. Like, this is going to be hard to move supply, infrastructure, and markets all at the same time. And taste moves slowly. Now, McDonald's had a seaweed burger in the 90s.
It did?
Seaweed burger called the McLean, which became the official burger of the National Basketball Association. And, you know, the blended burger is a thing now. But again, it's going to be difficult. I used to work with seafood chefs, and what I found was the chefs that were the best were the ones that knew vegetables. So Brooks Headley in New York, and his recipes are in the book, I gave him kelp noodles, and he did barbecue kelp noodles with parsnips and breadcrumbs, right? And so you get the heat of the barbecue sauce, the parsnips, that round flavor, and he just understood it. That said, we've got another strategy. So we'll try to make it kelp is the new kale. We're also going to try to make it soy of the sea, right? But not evil. So soy, we know, deforestation, monoculture, addicted to pesticides and fertilizers. We grow. You know,
and also getting wiped out by climate change. I mean, in some place in the Midwest, they're growing corn and soy are just totally screwed. But go ahead, I'm sorry.
And also trying to take over the aquaculture space because a lot of the fish feed, which is non-wild fish, is now soy. Because we're zero input food, we don't have those problems. But soy had a meeting. Big hulking soy guys have this image in the 50s. They're like, we're never going to get Americans to eat soy. So we're going to put it in everything. And it is in everything now. Food, you know, tables, chairs. It's just crazy. And kelp is similar. It can be used as a fertilizer and has been for generations. All those nutrients in the water, the phosphorus, the nitrogen, the carbon, there's too much of that in the ocean. Will we collect it with our seaweeds and bring it back to land to grow vegetables? Imagine we can actually have local fertilizer grown in Massachusetts and then used for city parks and things like that.
But that's what leads to the infrastructure discussion. Doesn't, I don't know, process might not be the right verb, but didn't you say that, that kelp needs to be somethinged within 30 minutes? Or mm-hmm. And so what is it, what's the need and what's the reality of the infrastructure to fill the need?
Yeah. So where we have infrastructure, and we, I mean like sort of the movement here, there's we have Request to Start Farms in every coastal state in North America and 20 countries around the world.
Wow.
And there is sort of like a tsunami now of interest. But where there's infrastructure, like in Alaska, up in Maine, different places like that, things are going really well, right? They're harvesting hundreds of thousands of pounds of kelp in Alaska, for example.
And doing well with it?
It's fertilizer, it's food, they're turning it into ingredients, and they're doing a great job. Where there's no infrastructure, really a challenge, because you have to get kelp out of the water, and you got to shut off that oxygen because it wilts, and you got to get it blanched and dried or frozen pretty quickly. So I think that's the that's going to be the big question. And all the benefits of growing in the water, right? It's cheap. $20,000, 20 acres in a boat. You can build one of these farms and get going. But you hit land, you face all the challenges that land-based farmers. It's expensive, right? It's low margin. And I think that's just a nut we really have to crack.
We're talking to Brent Smith. The new book is Eat Like a Fish, My Adventures as a Fisherman Turned Restorative Ocean Farmer. So I've been reading a lot about lobstermen and the fights about the ropes for lobster and the right whales. Yeah. Are you worried about that with your ropes?
Mm. So I got a great email a couple of years ago, a woman that said, I'm really worried that sharks are going to get lost in your farm in the kelp. Can you make shark highways? another woman wanted to do a birthing center underwater. A lot of crazies out there. But so we've never had any entanglements yet. We do sort of these quick releases that and pressure over 1,000 pounds will release. But part of this, as we move into different states, we work in 7 states now as GreenWave as our nonprofit, is to do a landscape analysis, look at the infrastructure, look at the latent capacity, look at the economics of it, and the ocean planning and what makes sense. There is a lot of room out there. We just need to do it in a sensible way. I think the vision is sea trust, just like land trusts on land. Let's do sea trust. 1,000-acre areas, we do reforestation of kelp. We're farming kelp, breathing life back into that ecosystem with a fishery there. And you just have this sort of this, you know, climate resilient zone, and you replicate those. You know, as we say, like, let's build reefs, not walls these days.
What is it? You know, you mentioned the Alaska experience. What's in the non-hot spots, the non-Maines, the non-Alaskas, what are people doing with kelp? Particularly in the food area, but any area, what are they doing with kelp?
So kelp noodles. So the thing about kelp, you have to realize it doesn't taste like seaweed.
What does it taste like?
Yeah, that's why it's a great gateway drug, right? It's really mild tasting, and wherever you grow, it tastes a little different.
It looks disgusting, though. Would you not agree?
So when you blanch it,
looks better than
yes,
seaweed.
I would agree.
Okay,
because I'm a realist.
Okay,
and I'm not a foodie. But when you blanch it, it turns bright green. Like on my boat, I boiling water, you dip a piece of kelp and it turns bright green, and it's like this great magic show.
Its natural color is like a dark green kind of thing, dark, blackish green.
Yeah. And by the way, that is nitrogen and carbon and all these things that we have too much of that we need to soak up. So the aesthetics are actually good, but some of the things the folks are making, there's a great little startup in Seattle that called Barnacle Seafoods that's doing kelp salsas. It are pickling the stems of kelp. There are other folks that are doing sea greens butters. We're working on a right now and have it fully developed. It's coming on next year. Is a bouillon cube. So that trauma of the home chef of like, what do I do with this? That you can
trauma of the home chef. I love that. I feel traumatized every time I get behind the stove.
Yeah. And so, you know, you turn it into a bouillon cube instead of a chicken bouillon cube. When again, 1 pound of chicken takes 2,000 gallons of water, right? And kelp zero. Right? So use that as a basic stock, things like that. I think we'll figure it out. We got to do it fast enough.
You know, you talked before about how when you started out, well, you were started at home, but then you were around the Bering Sea and doing the big industrialized fishing. When you talk to your fellow fishermen that are in the regular fishing business, what do they think of the prospects for them? Are they getting discouraged or what?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I got laughed off the docks when I started, right? And that's okay. But over time, you know, the lobsters are gone from Long Island Sound. There are literally lobster wars right now on the border of New Brunswick and Maine because everything's moving forward. All the folks that were dragging, at least in my area, have disappeared. I think people forget how big the fleets were back in my day when I was doing this. They love the little artisanal fishery that seems really sustainable, but this was a huge industry. You know, I was making 60 to 80,000 bucks a year when I was on the
boats.
But
it's very dangerous.
Yeah, but it was a good middle-class job, yep. Right? You could have health care, own a house. You know, I had a motorcycle. I had a truck. I got audited by the IRS, and they took it all. Because I got
a wife,
I'm
you
sorry.
You're amazing. Go ahead.
But there's one other thing is that what's absolutely shocking about this, I thought this was going to be about transition of crusty fishermen like me. What's happened is we stepped back at GreenWave and looked at who's in the industry. It's majority women.
Really?
Right, so in the hatcheries, the policy space, farms, all through it, it's mostly women.
Why?
Have no idea. Okay. Right, it's fascinating. But could this be one of the first economies that's actually women are the architects of? But we've got Catherine Puckett in Block Island, Rhode Island. She's all right. She's got a pink boat. She grows oysters, clams, and kelp, and she's got all guy crew. They love their jobs, but they hate working on a pink boat.
Yeah, it's not very much.
But maybe that's
I guess.
The future, right?
Hey, Brent, before you go, by the way, I wanted to, for people who are actually interested in the business, you've got to tell us how to do that, how to connect with you. But first, let's assume, and you seem like a pretty candid kind of character, 5 years from now, we invite you back. Not what your hope is. What's your realistic expectation as to where this kind of vertical farming stands?
I think the sharks are going to come. Right? Sort of the sharks of Wall Street. They're already here. They see huge dollars out in the water because it's a blank slate. They can vertically integrate the industry. So I'm very worried about that, and it's going to happen. It already is. We hope to build our own system, you know, our own alternative parallel to that, and through GreenWave, thinking about, you know, how do you build what we call a reef, which is 50 farms in an area, a hatchery, processing hub, and then rings of entrepreneurs, and you replicate those reefs. So 5 years from now, I'm hoping to have 200 farms around the country, and not owned by me, you know, just a network of farms. And I think there'll be a lot of churn and failure, right? But because it's hard to grow in the ocean. I mean, I can't see my crops, and my soil turns over 1,000 times a day. It's insane. What a dumb place to grow, right? But we have to, right? That our food system is being pushed out to the ocean. One of the interesting things is going to be the role of data. In four states right now, we've embedded sensors, and farmers are getting paid to harvest data, $25,000 a year. So
wow.
Could the farm of the future be harvesting food, harvesting data, and harvesting ecosystem services like blue carbon, right? And maybe that's it. Like, we're obsessed with farm as food. I think we can spread that out in the era of climate change.
Brent, it's great
this
to meet
really
you. Good
exciting.
Luck with everything.
It's really exciting stuff. You know, it's one of the few things I hear encouraging about climate change, too, because so much of it is so, you're right, depressing and discouraging. So great to talk to you. Brent Smith is a former commercial fisherman. His book is Eat Like a Fish, My Adventures as a Fisherman Turned Restorative Ocean Farmer. Coming up, Jacques Pepin and his granddaughter Shori discuss their cookbook collaboration. You're listening to 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, we're replaying some of our favorite conversations about food and cooking, which includes the one we have with Jacques Pepin and his granddaughter, Shori Wesson, about their cookbook collaboration, A Grandfather's Lessons in the Kitchen with Shori.
So I suppose when you've been cooking with your grandfather since you were two, it's a natural result of this beautiful cookbook you guys have put together, Grandfather's Lessons in the Kitchen with Shori. And this kind of came after all these years, I guess, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it was so fun to work on this book with my grandfather. I really enjoyed the whole project. It was awesome.
What were you doing in the kitchen when you were two? Not too much, I presume.
No, not. I definitely wasn't, like, chopping or anything.
She was eating chocolate.
Mostly, yeah. No, I spent a lot of time just sort of sitting with my grandfather and my parents and maybe stirring sometimes and just helping in the few ways that I could.
Where did the idea come from, Ashok, to do this with Shori?
Well, it was always this way at the house. I mean, when Claudine was a year and a half, Claudine, that's Shori's
her mother,
mother,
yes.
I hold her in my arm and she stirred the pot. So she, quote, made it. So she was going to taste it. This is part of the way we live. And, you know, it starts, her father is a chef as well, and he had a big garden too. So he starts with the garden. Go get me some tarragon. That's not tarragon, that's parsley, that's chive, this, that too. And then going to the market. You know, I go to the market with her. I say, get me some tomato. Sure, they are ripe. Are they good? You want some pear? Smell them. What do they smell? You know, start handling the product, testing, looking, and little job in the kitchen.
Jacques, do you think you could hold me while I stir in the kitchen? Is that something we could do?
But you could hold me.
I think I could. You know what? When I read the story about you holding first your daughter and then your granddaughter and stirring, and because they are so proud that they had done something, a little kid is going to taste it, it really struck a chord. We speak to a food writer, Corby Kummer, every couple of weeks here, and we talk a lot about how when schools and other institutions try to introduce healthy food into kids' lives, they reject it up front. And what you essentially did with your kid and your grandkid is initiated this contact at a really early age where there was pride in the relationship, yes?
Yeah, and there is never any, quote, healthy food or anything. Just the food that food. We do. It is a mistake to give a reward for a kid who is 5 years old and ate spinach. Oh, my God. You don't do that. You put the thing on the table, that's what we're having tonight, that's all there is. So
tell us, Shori, what you've done. I mean, these are some, I was just looking at your tomato sauce recipe, and this looks like, and I'm not a very good cook, but this looks like something that I could do without too much trouble.
Yeah, I think that the idea is not necessarily to let your kids cook this by themselves, but to have it so that the whole family can cook together, and they're all really simple recipes and really delicious, I think. So I think that it's good, you know, it's kid-friendly food, but not like chicken nuggets.
Now, Shori, before you continue, I want you to, I'm a little embarrassed by this, but I decided last night I had to make one of the recipes. What is the single simplest recipe in the whole cookbook, and I did it? Can you guess? The curly dog. Now, I'm a big hot dog fan. Okay. Is that okay? I know hot dogs are not very healthy.
Right, right.
But I do all beef natural hot dogs from Heber National. So I get a passing grade for that?
Absolutely, yes.
And then you see these beautiful photographs of this hot dog that curls into a circle with all of these indentations. And you know what's amazing, Jacques? You do it and it works. It actually, you shake the pan and it curls into a circle. I put it on an English muffin. I made the pickle relish, dill pickle relish, because you like dill pickles,
yes.
I read, Shori.
Yeah.
It was spectacular.
Good. Well, this is a spectacular meal you've been
Now, I know this is a combination, grandfather and granddaughter, but you've got on page 11 something I think is very important for all of us, because I guess in the grown-up cookbooks you don't have a little section on good table manners, but you do here. Yeah. And, you know, it is terrible to say how many people you notice, they don't bring the food up to their mouth. They bring their mouth down to the food.
But you know, the beauty of it is that we have about 75 recipes there, but 36 of those, you can see them in a DVD.
Yes.
You see, in the thing. So you're talking about the table manner. That's what she had a bowl doing that, because I was the guinea pig. And she'd tell me, don't slouch. Don't put your elbow on the table. Don't speak with your mouth full.
Yeah.
Don't interrupt me. Don't, you know, so she had a good time telling me what to do.
And you have a whole section here, too, about folding napkins. So I wondered, is it Can you get away with the paper napkins when it's just the family, or should you always use cloth napkins?
No. Oh, no. We always use paper napkins with the family. I mean, when it's nice and it's like a holiday, then we'll use the cloth napkins, but okay. We usually just use the paper napkins.
Okay.
You know,
so
also, I
want to
disabuse
that.
Somebody. People who are listening are saying, well, of course, if you have a young kid who's 13 and she or he is desirous to go into the food industry, that isn't your desire from what I read. You just love this. Because what do you want to do with yourself, first of all?
I want to be a surgeon.
You do?
Yes.
Well, your grandfather's sort of a surgeon of a different type,
sure,
I should say.
Sure, out to bone out a chicken.
Exactly.
Yes, that's right.
But that's one of the, I think, the appeals of the book. It's just you've integrated this into your life as like a fun thing to do,
yeah,
no?
Absolutely, yeah.
But Jacques Pepin, you do have some good advice for people who think that their children do want to go into the restaurant business and become chefs. What do you tell those people to do who've got a kid that's 16 or 17 and thinks?
Well, certainly if I have a kid who wants to do that, I would take them during vacation and find a job in a cafeteria somewhere, starting like the dishwasher, then the dining room, kitchen. I mean, to expose them, the kid, because of television now, there is like 400 cookery shows on television, and we are big star now. So, you know, the kid get all enamored. But this is not the real life of the kitchen. So give him a taste of what's going on during the vacation. And after the summer, he still love it, then there is hope.
I'm so glad you said that, because, you know, it's sort of like when you see that kids who go to a college and their parents think they can dribble a basketball, they're going to be in the NBA. Everybody thinks they can be Anthony Bourdain or you or locally Joanne Chang. That's really an important message, that it's not all glamour in the kitchen, right?
Oh, no. And be, you know, I would advise a young person going into this. You say, what do you think? I know how to do a souffle or whatever. Say, it doesn't matter. Be on time. Be clean. You know, be willing. That's more important. And if you are like that, the chef will like you. And I mean, my son-in-law can tell you that. He teaches at Johnson & Well. And, you know, there is a lot of, you know, we used to be that years ago, cooking or going into that business was really low on the social scale. Any good mother would have wanted her child to marry a doctor or a lawyer. Now we are genius. I don't know what happened. but people have the wrong idea of what the business is all about.
You know, that's the voice of Jacques Pepin. His granddaughter, Shori, is here. You know, speaking of Johnson and Wales, which is reminded me of another Johnson, Howard Johnson, when I read about you and hear that you worked at Howard Johnson, what role did that play in the development of the now the famous Jacques
I would
Jacques
not
Pepin.
Know how to do a curly dog.
No, I'm serious.
Howard Johnson.
How important was that to your development as
this great chef and writer? It was 1960. I was offered the job at the White House for Kennedy or Howard Johnson. I went to
and
Howard
you turned
Johnson.
It down. Is that
yeah,
not
I
true?
Went to Howard Johnson, but. Eventually, I opened the World Trade Center in New York with Joe Baum, the commissary, too. Then I was a consultant for the Russian Tea Room in the 80s. I opened a restaurant in the 70s on Fifth Avenue in New York called La Potagerie. But I could never have done any of those jobs if I hadn't had the training of Howard Johnson.
What was the part of the training?
The production, marketing, production, enormous American eating habit, chemistry of food, you know, all stuff that I didn't know at a French chef, certainly, yes.
So, Shori, what are your favorite recipes in the book? Give us two or three that you really, really love making.
So, I mean, I am a dessert person. Mm-hmm. I love dessert. I've loved it since I was, like, two, you know. I really like the chocolate goblets, which is these balloons that we fill up and we dip them in melted chocolate.
Ooh.
And then we put them in the refrigerator. You pop the balloons and they come out. And then it's a little chocolate bowl and you can put whipped cream or fruit or whatever you want inside. I definitely like the cottage cheese pancakes a lot with the blueberries. Those are really, really good.
So you know, I want to ask you something unrelated to cooking for a second. You have been in a lot of spelling bees. Now,
yes.
My co-host here...
Oh, don't embarrass me.
My co-host here thinks that people that are in spelling bees are tortured by their teachers.
No,
or
don't
their
say.
Parents,
her parents are here, too. Don't do this, Marjorie.
You know, they have to do nothing but study spelling bees like 9 hours a day. But you're apparently managed to do the cooking, and I read that you are a musician and you're in gymnastics. So you're not in the closet with a dictionary 9 hours a day,
no,
apparently.
I started spelling bees sort of on a fluke in middle school because I read a lot, and I was like, I'm pretty good at spelling. I'll try... spelling. I came in second place in my school in sixth grade and 16th in the state in seventh grade.
Wow.
So I, it's not really something that I'm super focused on.
Okay.
Part of me is like, I want to go to the National Bee, and the other part of me is like, what if I go to the National Bee because I'll probably fail, so... You know.
Okay.
The only reason she asked that question, Shori, is so she can embarrass me. Trust me. You know, Jacques Pepin, if you could see the look on your face when your granddaughter is speaking, the pride in it, it is well, a beautiful thing.
You know, the kitchen is also a background. First, it's kind of a glue for us to hold people together in the family.
Family, sure.
In addition to that, when you're past 80 years old, how do you speak to a teenage? You know, I mean, I'm fast with my finger when I have a knife, but she's faster when she holds her iPhone or iPad, all that stuff. So, you know, at least it's a common ground where we can talk, and one thing lead to another. I mean, in the kitchen, we talk about mathematics. I say, give me 2 tablespoons of butter. You know, how many tablespoons you have in that stick? How many sticks you have in a pan? How many tablespoons you have in that cup of water? Or we talk about tomato. I say, where does tomato come from? Geography, is that a fruit, that a vegetable? To, you know, you can do a lot through cooking, you know.
Okay, so your hope here is that young people can learn to make some, you know, as I say, non-chicken nugget, non-macaroni and cheese out of a box, even though I hear that's your favorite junk food, I read in the book, sure, kind of thing. Is there still hope for older people? Marjorie Egan over there, the only dish she can make is prune chicken. Oh. And she's not a kid anymore. Is she? Could she still learn, or is it too late for her?
There is hope. There is hope.
Well, there's hope. But you know what it is, though? I mean, I can follow a recipe and make something, but I think... unless you start at an earlier age, you don't have that feel for the right ingredients. Sort
this
of a
book
sense
is for, I'm telling you, this book
how,
is not just for kids. It's for
right.
people like you and
exactly.
me.
Exactly.
You know
I'm
I mean?
Not condescending here to kids. We do very good recipes. She loves fish. For example, we do a Arctic char. Well, sure, okay, we do that salmon or Arctic char, I say. We cut a piece, put it skin side down in a non-stick skillet. Yeah. No butter, no fat, nothing, a bit of salt. We cover it. I heat. So by covering it, it brings some steam. It cooks the top. So we don't never turn the fish. You leave it 5-6 minutes on the skin. You have a nice, crisp skin, and it's just moist on top and barely cooked. And I said, okay, let's do a sauce with it. So I had a tomato that day. We cut the tomato in 2 pieces, put it in a bowl. She had a hand blender, make a puree of it with a tablespoon of olive oil, salt, pepper.
Ooh.
And then you had that puree of fresh tomato. I said, put that in the microwave. You know, 30 seconds so that it's not cold, lukewarm, and we serve with the fish. We do that. So
I have a question, Jacques Pepin, about a cultural thing.
Oh, that
you
is
mentioned.
Pretty. Shori's showing the photo. Ooh, the photographs are beautiful in the book, too.
The photographs are beautiful. That is it, you know, I talked to you before about growing up, and you were very involved in, you know, cooking and, you know, helping out and all that kind of thing at a young age. But is it a cultural thing? I have this fantasy about the French, that they're hanging around the dinner table for, you know, a half hour, an hour, maybe an hour and a half at dinner. So we're all in such a rush in the United States.
Arguing. Slow food.
Yeah.
Arguing.
Arguing. That's right. But is there a cultural thing about what you grew up with and what you see in the United States in terms of, or is it changing here?
Well, it's changing here. Sometimes it's changing for the better. I mean, when I came to America over 50 years ago, there was only one salad in the supermarket. That was iceberg. There was no leek, no shallot, no oriental vegetable. Supermarkets have never been as beautiful as they are today. Mm.
Yeah.
And look at all the farmers' market. Now close to 1,000 farmers' market in the United States. So, you know, people say no one cook anymore. What do they do with the stuff at the end of the week? I mean, someone must be cooking.
Yeah.
Buying the stuff, you know.
Sure. So. Do your contemporaries like cooking? To your fellow 13 and 14 year olds, or are they too intimidated by it, or interested in other things? What is it?
I think that we enjoy the process of cooking because we will spend time together. Sometimes we'll go over to my friend's house and we'll decide to make something, but it's usually not about the food and the product. It's mostly just about like how we spend time together and finding the recipe and making the things. Like,
that's great.
Do you share your lunch with the kid in school?
Lunch is different. Lunch is a harder topic.
Why? What do you mean?
I mean, with lunch, it's more everyone is there. And so if you have a weird lunch, then there's more social problems with that. But
okay. Okay.
By the way, if you just tune in, that's the voice of Shori, as in the title, Grandfather's Lessons in the Kitchen with Shori. It's written by Jacques Pepin with photographs, which are great, by Tom Hopkins. And you do the illustrations, which are really fabulous.
Illustrated...
And by the way,
she did too.
You both worked on them.
Yes.
Is this a rooster? Is this chicken? What is this?
Yeah.
Rooster? Chicken?
Yes, this is a nasty rooster.
Speaking of nasty rooster, I want to talk to you about that. Your daughter was kind of, you brought us gifts, both of us, with your illustrations. Your daughter said the reason she gave me this mug, this is your mother we're talking about, Shori, is because the head of this rooster, who looks really angry, she says, reminds her of me when I'm talking on the radio. Do you think that looks anything like me, Jacques?
No, that looks much better than you.
So, Jacques Pepin, you mentioned at the beginning how when you were cooking with your own daughter when she was a baby, how you'd help her, she'd stir the pot so she'd taste it. I mean, that is a big thing, it would seem to me, that if you do get your children involved in an early age with the cooking, then they are much more likely to be adventurous.
Sure. I mean, look at the house now. The house that we do now, it's like a big kitchen with space around. We eat in the kitchen. So, you know, when you come back from school, what better place is there for a child to sit down and do your own work in the kitchen? The smell that you have there, the taste that you have, the noise of the instrument in the kitchen, the voice of your mother, your father, that stay with you the rest of your life, you know?
Yeah. Do you do that? Do you do that? Do you cook with your parents?
Well, when I'm with my parents at home and they're cooking, it's usually just a normal school night for me, so I have a bunch of other things that I have
homework.
To do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Homework, sports, instruments, everything that I have to do, so it's a lot harder to spend that time. But when I'm with my grandfather, we're usually away from home or it's a special occasion, so it's a lot easier to find the time to cook with my grandfather.
Yeah, speaking of your parents, your mother is the daughter of Jacques Pepin. Can this woman cook or no? Can she? Let's out her right here.
Oh,
is she
I
any
mean,
good?
She's right there. No.
I know she is. You're not. Don't look at her. Look at me.
I think she's a really good cook.
We were talking to Jacques Pepin and Shori Wesson about their cookbook collaboration, A Grandfather's Lessons in the Kitchen with Shori. Up next, we talk to activist Dolores Huerta. Keep your dial on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Boston Public Radio. Today we're replaying some of our favorite conversations about food, cooking, and food policy. We continue the conversation with Dolores Huerta, co-founder of the United Farm Workers, along with Cesar Chavez. She pushed for better wages and working conditions, and she joined us ahead of Dolores Huerta Day.
Many people remember your battle for farm workers' rights back in the 60s and 70s. Before we get to how relevant that is today, give us a sense of what it was like back then, what farm workers were enduring, what those of you who tried to fight for their rights endured.
Well, when we started organizing farm workers, they were being paid like 70 cents an hour. They had no bathrooms in the fields at all. You can imagine what this was like, especially for the women. Where they're out there in the field is probably 20 miles from the nearest town and no gas stations, no public bathrooms at all for them to go to. They were not provided water. Oh, by the way, on the bathrooms, you can imagine what that was like, especially for the women, where they had to take towels or sheets and make a circle around each other when they had to do their business. There were no potable drinking water provided to the workers at all. The conditions were miserable, no rest periods, working from sunup to sundown, no overtime pay, nothing like that. So, the poverty was just cruel, the poverty that they were living in. So we definitely had to do something to change those conditions.
And you did. And I think it's fair to say the two of you helped change the world. But when you look at today, despite the progress you made, and you see, I don't know what the precise number is, somewhere in the neighborhood of 500,000 farm workers, agricultural workers, came down with COVID-19. The working conditions in plenty of places continue to be atrocious. What does that say to you, Dolores Huerta?
Well, that we still have, unfortunately, a situation where farm workers are still not respected or recognized. Just recently in the state of Florida, the governor DeSantis there decided that farm workers should not get vaccinated or could not get vaccinated until they provided an identification. And many of the farm workers are undocumented. Many of them do not live permanently in the state of Florida because they're migrant workers. Those workers will be traveling up to upstate New York. They'll be traveling to Georgia, North Carolina, and some of these other states. And if they're not vaccinated, if any of them have COVID, they will carry that with them. And so that I think this is very typical of the types of decisions that are made, that bad decisions are made that affect farm workers. The other thing is that we have unemployment insurance benefits for farm workers, very comprehensive workers' compensation if they get hurt on the job, disability insurance, and of course the right to organize. Unfortunately, I would say that the majority, probably besides California and Hawaii, the other states of the United States of America do not have comprehensive workers' compensation when they get hurt on the job. They do not have unemployment insurance when they're caught between jobs where they're migrating. And you know, they don't have the right to form a union. So we still have a lot of work to do with farm workers in the other states. I think New York State just recently, in 2019, they did approve a bill of rights for farm workers that Carrie Kennedy, Robert Kennedy's daughter, had been working on for about a dozen years. And in Colorado, they are now just considering a bill to give some rights to farm workers that they don't have. But these do not include unemployment insurance or the right to organize.
Where is the Biden administration on vaccinations for people who are not American citizens, who are farm workers, who are working in the fields?
Didn't Jill Biden join you in California the other day, Dolores Huerta?
Yes, she did. And actually, we actually had the discussion about what's happening in Florida. And we were also able to talk to one of the people from who just got back on to the Agricultural Commissioner by Vilsack. His name is Oscar Gonzalez, about the situation. And he just was just recently rehired to work with the Department of Agriculture. So we're hoping that those conversations will lead to something, to do something in Florida.
You know, we're talking with Dolores Huerta. She's the co-founder of the United Farm Workers. You know, Dolores, I like to think that what you as organizers went through years ago will not have to be repeated. But I had forgotten until I was reading about you in preparation for talking to you today, the kind of violence you did endure. Picketers sprayed with sulfur. You were beaten by the San Francisco police. You broke ribs.
Yes. And unfortunately, we see that that type of violence still it is in effect when it comes to people that are protesting. And that's unfortunate. But of course, that doesn't mean that people should stop protesting or stop marching, because this is the way that you can get the message out to the American public of changes that need to be made.
You know, when you were honored a bunch of years ago by President Obama, did the two of you have a conversation about si se puede or yes we can, which most people credit to Barack Obama?
That's right.
But I think a lot of us know that it started with you. Did you talk to the president about that?
Ask him if he stole your line.
Well, actually, the first conversation that I had with President Obama when I met him, and that was, of course, when he was running for the presidency. And the first thing he said to me after he said hello was, "I stole your slogan."
He did. Can you tell the story, Dolores Huerta? Can you tell the story about how it came to be?
Well, my response to the president when he said that is, I said, "Yes, you did."
Very good. Yeah. I love that.
What were the circumstances that caused you to say it? I think it was in Arizona. Was it not? Am I right about that?
Yeah, that's right. And actually, Cesar Chavez had been doing a 25-day water-only fast because in the state of Arizona, they had passed a law that was signed by the governor that if a farm worker went on strike, they could go to prison. And if anybody said boycott anything, you could also go to be in prison for that. And so Cesar started a fast kind of bring to the attention of the world of what was happening to farm workers in Arizona. So And I was, of course, with other people, organizing people to come to join us every night. We had a rally, we had a mass. And in speaking to some of the professional Latinos in Arizona, I said to them, I was inviting them to come and to help us in this campaign that we were doing against the governor and to join us with Caesar's Fast. And they told me, in California, you can do all of those things, but in Arizona, you can't. And in Spanish, that's no se puede. Mm-hmm. No se puede in Arizona. And my response to them was, sí se puede. And that evening when I went to give a report to our rally, when I said, I gave them that report, and I mentioned that my response was, sí se puede, everybody jumped up and they started clapping their hands and saying, sí se puede, sí se puede. So that's how it was born. I like to say it came from the universe.
Well, it did, and it stayed with us in beautiful kinds of ways. We're talking to Dolores Huerta.
So how much does our immigration policy play into what's happening with farm workers in 2021, Dolores?
Well, it plays a lot, and it's really interesting because I think part of the one of the immigration bills that they have in the Congress is to bring in more foreign workers into the labor force. And right now, usually in all of the rural areas, we do have high unemployment. And of course, now with the pandemic, it's been even worse. And so bringing in foreign workers, more foreign workers will really not help the situation. So, we have to really take care of the local farm workers, of the farm workers that are in the labor force right now, and, make life easier for them. So provide proper transportation for them so they can get to the work site. And in transportation that would be safe, I think one of the problems that we had during the pandemic is that farm workers are transported often in either buses or vans, and there's no spacing. They were not provided the PPE that they needed. That's why so many of them were infected. And in fact, in some instances here in California, farm workers actually had to do a work stoppage so the employers would provide them with the protective equipment. And some employers even fired workers if they didn't come back to work when they protested because they didn't get the PPE.
Are you hopeful that every few weeks, Dolores Huerta, we speak to Ali Noorani, who is the head of something called the National Immigration Forum. And we were talking to him the other day about the possibility of comprehensive immigration reform when Senator Manchin came back from the border. And he said, realistically, what is much more likely is a pared-down immigration reform, one that deals with the so-called Dreamers and one that provides a path to citizenship for agricultural workers in this country. Are you hopeful that there can be 60 votes in the Senate to support such a thing?
I think so. I know Senator Feinstein has had a bill in the in the Congress for, I guess, the last 8 years or so to try to give a special recognition to farm workers and a special pass to citizenship for the farm workers. So I think that if Senator Manchin says it, that kind of is a good indication that could happen. And I do see a climate changing in our country right now, when we have more compassion that is being exhibited, especially with when our president is out there speaking for the poor and working people. So I think it's possible. I think that doesn't really take care of the total immigration issue because we have people that work like in construction. Many people who do take care of the children of the elderly, do the cleaning of buildings, et cetera. So we have a lot of the workforce isn't documented, and those workers also have to be addressed also.
When you say we're making a lot of progress in this country on some fronts, and obviously switching from an anti-union, anti-worker president to one who talks about those issues all the time is a plus, but we've heard preliminary results from a very important union election out of Bessemer, Alabama for Amazon. Half the votes have been counted, and it looks so far like a 2-1 no vote. When I was younger, I was a union president, and I organized in some southern states much harder. And by the way, our greatest inspiration was you and Cesar Chavez, I should say. So that's why it's so thrilling for me to talk to you today.
Thank you.
If unions continue, numbers continue to decline, it's very hard to achieve the kinds of goals that you fought your whole life for, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And it's unfortunate that you have this anti-union sentiment, especially in the South and places like Texas, these right-to-work laws.
Yeah.
You know, when you think of unions, they are part of our democratic institutions. And because basically what a union is, it's an organization of workers. And when you think of the employers, they have many organizations that they belong to. I could say like the agricultural employers, they have, the Farm Bureau Federation, the Western Association of Growers, the Associated Farmers, on and on and on. But so when workers should have that same democratic right of having their own organization so that they can be represented not only on the work site, but also in the state legislatures and in the U.S. Congress. So this anti-union sentiment is actually anti-democratic. And we know that labor unions are essential to our democracy because labor unions create the middle class, and you cannot have a democracy if you do not have a middle class.
Have you met the former mayor of Boston, who is the new Secretary of Labor, who, as you probably know, Marty Walsh, comes from a union background. He was the head of the building trades here in Boston. Have you had an opportunity to meet him, Dolores Huerta?
I may have met him in the past. His name is very familiar to me and his face, but, in my travels, I have met many, many people. and I have been in Boston in the past. So we may have run across, mm-hmm. across each other. Huh?
Dolores Huerta, I learned that you had 11 children. They're grown up now, obviously. I'm sure you got a lot of grandchildren as well. But I also know that you're a big supporter of the ERA, the Rights for Women. I'm wondering what you learned trying to be an organizer, co-founder of the United Farm Workers, and bring up 11 kids. Women have a very bifurcated life in this regard, the workforce and home. Tell us about how you managed, mm-hmm. and why you support the ERA.
Well, I pretty much did what all women do, is we have to ask for help with our children. And I think that's important that women need to understand that I know we're supposed to have the sole responsibility mm-hmm. to raise our children, to care for our children. But that's why a universal child care is so important. And I know that this is on President Biden's agenda, because we do need women, not only in the workforce, but we need women in civic life. And every woman should, and every family should not have to worry about if their children are being taken care of. And if we have universal child care, not only are they safe, but they're also being educated. So this, I think, is a really top priority for women. And for the Equal Rights Amendment, my goodness, in 2021, we can make history. In 2020, we celebrated the 100th year of women having the right to vote, but the anniversary when women got the right to vote. But in 2021, we can actually celebrate that the Equal Rights for Women will be part of the Constitution of the United States of America. So this is really important. And in fact, there is a website right now for the listeners, if you want more information on the Equal Rights Amendment. It's erayes2021.org. That's erayes2021.org. And we do hope that the U.S. Senate will, clear the path so that we can have, finally, the equal rights for women be part of the Constitution of the United States.
By the way, for people who are confused about what the status is last year, correct me if I'm wrong, Dolores, the 38th state, which is what was needed, Virginia, ratified, mm-hmm. which should have made it part of the Constitution, but opponents of the ERA contend that the deadline for ratification has expired, and that's why the House has already accepted it. The critical issue is whether the Senate can pull together the votes to say that there was no expiration date and that it is now part of the Constitution of the United States of America.
Yeah, and I believe that expiration date has been moved a couple of times.
It has.
And I think there is a legal decision that says that it can be moved again.
Dolores Huerta, you worked for many years, of course, with Cesar Chavez. People regard him as a hero, for his bravery in uniting the farm workers, obviously, with you as well. But you got any good little inside dope stories, about him that we may not know that were part of his personality or part of what you enjoyed about working with him?
Well, he was not a very good joke teller.
Okay.
All of his jokes were very, very corny, you know.
Oh.
But people would laugh, I think, just to be polite, you know.
Yeah. You remember any? Yes.
No, I don't. I really don't, because they were not really funny. So.
Oh, that's too bad.
But he was a very committed individual. He was totally committed to farm workers. People would say to Caesar, well, you're the leader of the Chicano movement. And he'd say, no, I'm not. He said, I am the president of the Farm Workers Union. Caesar was very, very humble. And often when people would say, I remember once when people were shouting, Viva Chavez, Viva Chavez. And he kind of winced. And I said, Caesar, something wrong? He said, I really don't like to hear that. He says, I really don't like to hear that. So he was also very forgiving. In that many people, I remember another time when one of those people was shouting Viva Chavez, and he said, I remember when that individual would not even give me a meeting, would not even meet with me to talk about organizing farm workers. So,
wow.
And people that would badmouth him, because during the 60s, we were considered by some of the very militant organizations, we were not militant enough for them. And then the other organizations on the right wing, they would call us communists and radicals. And so we were sort of kind of in the middle. And some of those people then afterwards would come up to Caesar, and he was just very, very polite with them, even though they had been saying terrible things about him.
You know, by the way, before you go, when you mention how humble the great Cesar Chavez was, the great Dolores Huerta was pretty humble herself. I remember the story about when he said, who's going to nominate you for vice president of the union? Your response was, I don't need that title. I don't need it. Isn't that what you said to him?
Yes, that's exactly what I said. And I just want to say that in terms of being a feminist and having a feminist lens on, we definitely have to change that. And it's been a little difficult for me to also change my stance on something like that, because I think we as women, so often we are so socialized that we are here to serve others, especially men, and that we have to really kind of change that to take credit for the work that we do, not to be able to stand up and be proud of who we are, and kind of, you know, just and not think that we're conceited when we stand up for ourselves. And that's, I think, just part of our socialization that we have to change as women. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I always feel that I get a lot of recognition, but I'm also standing on the backs of the 5 martyrs that were killed in the United Farm Workers. The first one, a young woman from Boston named Ann Friedman, who was killed in a sugarcane strike in Florida. She was run down by a truck. Our second martyr was an Arab, Naji Daifala, who was killed by a deputy sheriff here in Kern County, California. And then we had 3 other martyrs, Rufino Contreras, who was killed, met by a hail of bullets in a letter strike in Calexico, and Dene Lopez, the young man who was killed because he organized his company to vote for the union. This was after the ALRB was passed. And then we had Juan de la Cruz, who was shot in the heart by a labor contractor. So, you know, I get a lot of recognition, but all of our 5 martyrs and many of the farm workers who were beaten and then went to jail, many lost their homes, lost their cars. So these are the shoulders of the people that I stand on. And of course, that Cesar did also. So, and they're not recognized. Their names are not known.
Dolores, we're almost out of time here, but I know you're celebrating your 90th year here. You sound like you're about 50. Do you have any tips? I mean, did you eat a lot of, you know, take 1 a day vitamin? Do you have any secrets to share about how we can sound like you if we make it as long as you have?
Yeah, well, I'm actually going to be 91.
91? Oh,
sorry.
Oh, God. Excuse me.
No, it's okay. Basically, I think we just have to keep busy, keep active. Okay. And, I keep very, very busy. And I'm also a vegetarian. And so I think that also helps a lot. You know, but the main thing is just to keep physically active and keep mentally active. I think that helps a lot.
Okay.
Dolores,
well,
we're at the happy 91, and we were thrilled to be able to speak to you today. Thank you so much for calling in.
Well, thank you very much. And by the way, si se puede, it has kind of a double meaning, because it not only does it mean Yes, we can, but it also means, yes, I can. So I think that's really important for all of us. So we can remember by working together, taking direct nonviolent action, that we can definitely make progress in our nation, especially at this critical time.
So great.
Thank
to
you very
to
you. Much.
Thank
a pleasure so much. To talk to you.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
We were speaking to Dolores Huerta, co-founder of the United Farm Workers. Along with Cesar Chavez, she pushed for better wages and working conditions. We spoke to her earlier this year ahead of Dolores Huerta Day. Coming up, we discuss the art and science of baking bread. That conversation is next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
This is Boston Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, we're replaying some of our favorite conversations about food culture, food policy, and cooking. We pick things up with Chef Nathan Myhrvold. He's giving bread the love and attention it deserves in his book, Modernist Bread, The Art and Science. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. And Cervantes said, all sorrow is less with bread. Well, I guess Nathan Myhrvold, or as his family calls it in Norway, he just told me, Myhrvold, is that correct?
Yes.
Well, thank you. Okay. Has obliterated sorrow altogether by way of his latest work, Modernist Bread, The Art and Science. It's 6 volumes. It's right here in our studio, wrapped, if that's the proper word, in stainless steel, spanning over 2,500 pages of history, technique, recipe, food photography, which doubles as fine art. Nathan is the founder of The Cooking Lab. He co-authored The Modernist Bread with head chef Francisco Migoya. Nathan, it's a pleasure to meet you. Thanks for coming by.
Well, thank you. Oh, great to be here.
This is where we really need to be on television, because Nathan just wheeled in the book and took it out of your case, and it is indeed 50 pounds, right?
Yeah, but 53.
But it's in separate sections so that we can pull out individual sections and look at them. So tell people, 2,000 plus pages, 50 pounds, what exactly are you doing here?
Yeah, this is a polite version of what I call the what were you thinking question. And we set out to write a great book about bread that was covered history, because bread has enormous rich history. The science of how bread works. Of course, bread is a product of fermentation, so you have yeast and sourdough bacteria that are involved. And also recipes and techniques, how you actually make the stuff.
You know, point of this, I read a quote of yours from your earlier massive work, Modernist Cuisine. Here's your line. When you whisk together some oil and lemon juice and make mayonnaise, you're using the principles of physics and chemistry there. I think that understanding how these principles affect cooking helps you cook better. And by the way, former chief tech guy at Microsoft in your former life, we
big
should
wig,
say.
Big wig at Microsoft.
I agree in the abstract, but is it for people like me to digest, and I do mean that as a pun, that intersection of science and food, or is it for people like you? Who's that? Who's the audience? No, I'm serious. Who's the audience?
Well, I like to say it's for people who are passionate and curious about food. Now, if you're not passionate about it, a 2,500-page book is probably overkill. Also, you need to be curious. So most recipe books say, do this, do this, do this, and you get a result. And if you're happy doing this, 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 well, it's great. You get all these recipes. You can make them. If you wonder why, that's where I have a proposition for you. Because I think many of us wonder, well, why am I doing this step? Or why does this recipe say I must always do this, and the other recipe in this other book says I must never do that? What's up with that? And people, since time immemorial, have wanted to understand their world. Science is the way of understanding your world with stories that check out to be true when you test them.
Well, you know, it's interesting, by the way, despite what I just said, which was somewhat cynical, I realized one of my kids' favorite books as a kid was How Does It Work? Which is essentially
work?
A kid's version of what you've done here in massive content.
Yes, and even if you don't bake bread, if you wonder how it works, I think I have a proposition for you.
I think you do.
Okay, the book is The Modernist Bread, The Art and Science. Nathan Myhrvold is the author. And so I am humiliated to think, because one of the things I have loved in my life, and I used to live at a place where we used to bake our own bread, was the smell of bread. It never occurred to me to ask why where that comes from. Why does bread smell so great? And you talk about that.
Yeah, so it's a little bit of a mystery to me as to why bread that is just coming out of the oven smells so damn good. Now, for a lot of things that smell good or taste good to us, there's a strong evolutionary reason. Our ancestors have eaten that stuff for a long time. Bread is recent enough that we shouldn't have, like, become adapted to it. So I don't really know why it smells so good, but I kind of know a little bit about how. And it comes from volatile compounds that are made by the yeast when the bread is proofing or rising. We proved that by making some bread without yeast, which isn't very good as bread, but it doesn't smell that way.
Really?
Yeah.
So it's that. Because it is incredible when you do try to bake bread yourself to watch how it, like, it's like a chemical experiment in some ways, isn't it, the way it rises
it's a
up?
Biology experiment.
Biology experiment, whatever.
You know, Nathan, you mentioned a second ago our ancestors. I also don't know, until I started reading about your book, the history. Where did this all start, this bread thing with humankind?
The conventional story is that bread is maybe 10,000 years old, because that's roughly the date of a large-scale grain agriculture, that people started growing wheat, barley, and other grains in large quantity to feed themselves, and someone invented bread. But then a Canadian archaeologist found a cave in Mozambique, and that cave had round pounding stones in it that had been used to pound wild sorghum. It still had the grains of the sorghum embedded in the rock, and it dated to 100,000 years ago.
Oh, my God.
Now, we don't know what they were pounding the wild sorghum for, but they were kind of making flour. So we think it was bread. And in fact, in other parts of Africa, there is a bread called injera, which is made in some parts of the country or of the continent with sorghum. And it's sort of like a sorghum gruel that you allow to ferment, so it's a sourdough. And then traditionally it was baked by pouring out on a hot rock. And so I think that's what those people are doing. And we created a picture in the book that was a reconstruction of that first bread.
You know, speaking of pictures in the book, and I have to reach over and see the magazine.
Incredible.
How do you like, for example, I'm looking at a photograph of a mixer with, I think, dough in it. And it's this cross shot. I mean, it's this cross section. How did you do this? I mean, how is this picture? How'd you do this?
We cut things in half.
I guess.
You did?
I mean, look how incredible.
Yeah. So, one of the things that we started doing in my first cookbook was we wanted to explain what goes on in your food and in your cooking equipment while you're cooking. And I thought about using illustrations, but I thought, let's actually cut things in half. So we do. Now, for describing how the bread itself works, we cut loaves of bread in half when they were partially baked or fully baked and other things. But you also wonder what's going on in your equipment. So we cut a KitchenAid mixer in half.
That's what I was looking at. Yeah, why not?
We cut a microwave oven in half. We cut all kinds of ovens and other gadgets.
One thing before we move more into modern times.
Well, one thing before he starts slicing bread. I mean, he has bread in front of him. The smell is ridiculous.
I had no idea that bread was such a huge part of people's diet, too. You talk about that this was what people spent a lot of their money on, was buying bread. And that was
a primary calorie source ages ago. Yeah,
it was a primary calorie source in Europe up through most of the 19th century. So this wasn't like, oh, yes, in the distant past, the ancient Egyptians. I mean, yes, it was for them. And, of course, if you have a society based on grain agriculture, you have basically two choices, porridge or bread. What are you going to pick?
I guess.
I want you to know, while you and Marjorie were just speaking, Nathan, for those who say, well, I think I'm interested in this cookbook, even though it's 2,462 pages long, I just bench-pressed Volume 3, and I actually, it's the best I've felt in weeks. So you brought a bunch of bread. Can we say where it's from?
Sure.
It's our favorite bakery, our favorite and great friend, Joanne Chang,
God,
from Flower. Why'd you bring it? What are you going to do?
Well, I thought we could talk a little bit about bread and
do it.
The structure of bread. I mean, it, here you see a...
so pretty.
This is a country-style bread, it says. Mm-hmm. It's shaped like a ball.
It is.
Now, an interesting thing is that the French name for a bakery is boulangerie. That means ball maker.
It does?
Yes. Boule. Ball. So it's that is what they used to make was round loaves of bread. And in the past, much bigger than today. We found a study by a French scientist in the 1840s who went around Paris buying loaves of bread, measuring them. The smallest loaves this guy dealt with were 2 kilos, 4.5 pounds.
Wow.
And now the reason is, if bread is a primary source of calories, that means each person is eating a pound or more of bread a day. So you don't come home with one little petite loaf for your family.
Or baguette, which is what I always think of.
Well, baguettes didn't exist in the 1840s.
Yeah.
The first baguette was probably baked in 1918.
The first baguette is only 100 years... The first one was baked 100 years ago? Well, the conventional wisdom, which I was just disabused of, is a lot of these baguette-like kinds of breads harken back to days of yore. They do not, apparently. No,
they don't. The funniest one is ciabatta bread.
Sure.
Ciabatta bread was invented in the 1980s.
Really?
And the Italian baker who invented it filed for a trademark. So we know exactly when it was done.
So while you're cutting that flour, a country bread, your co-author, who is a legendary baker, said something that I read this weekend, like there is a place for white sandwich bread, a la Wonder. What is the place for that and why?
Well, I'm not sure he actually meant supermarket Wonder bread, but for sandwiches, sandwich bread works really well. And there's been a lot of sort of naming and shaming around
bread.
White bread. Well,
yes.
Bread in general.
Yes.
But also around bread made with white flour or white bread. And it really isn't warranted.
Oh, good news.
Yeah.
Why isn't it warranted?
We're
it's empty calories,
whole gray,
isn't it?
Everybody says, right?
We're attacking our guest, Nathan Myhrvold, here. Go ahead. He's the bread expert.
But I have the bread knife.
I'm ready for a piece of that bread if you want to
hand it over, buddy.
Yeah, because it looks awfully really good pretty. To me. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Nathan.
Oh, my goodness, it's so soft.
What is the redeeming quality of Wonder Bread or the Wonder Bread-like things?
Okay, well, let's separate into two things. The first is whole wheat flour or whole grain flours are neither more nutritious for you nor are they better for you.
My God.
Yes.
I thought we were all sinning by giving our children white bread.
You're not.
Oh, good.
Now, this is so counter to what everybody knows that pretty soon you're going to be like thinking I'm some guy from the X-Files saying the truth is out there.
Yeah,
and it's like all this wacky conspiracy stuff.
By the way, we think that already. I want to be clear here. So just, it's not going to take much longer. But go ahead. Continue.
So it turns out that if you really look at the nutritional studies, whole wheat bread is not more nutritious, for a variety of reasons. The key difference between a whole wheat bread and a regular bread is the inclusion of bran and also the wheat germ. Well, there are a couple of nutrients that are in there that aren't in the white bread, but there's also a very strong thing called the anti-nutrient effect. There's chemicals called phytates that are in the bran, which leach out in your gut, and they bind to other minerals and nutrients and prevent you from absorbing them. So, for example, whole grain bread largely blocks the absorption of iron. So if you are eating lots of whole grain bread and you're a little anemic, you're making it worse.
Wow. Wow. Why haven't I heard this anywhere?
Well, especially since you're white bread.
White flour. We're all supposed to be they got whole wheat pasta, whole wheat everything. So
we're talking
to
Nathan Myhrvold, a co-author of and man behind Modernist Bread.
So
bread has gotten a bad rap in general, though. People say, oh, if you're on a diet, don't eat the bread. Don't eat the bread. I love bread. It's one of my favorite foods in the world.
Well, it's one of my favorites, too. You know, if you love bread too much, I can see why you might take that out of your diet a little bit. one of the things I always do when you do a cookbook is go on eBay to find old advertisements. Mm-hmm. And I found an advertisement from, I think, Saturday Evening Post in 1920s. And it was a flour company. And it says, eat more bread. Make it 50% of your diet. Now, could you imagine that today? No. You could never say that. And of course, one of the things that's funny about our attitudes about bread is that culturally, there's this memory of it being a primary source of calories, of it being our daily bread, you know, the breadwinner of the family. All of those sayings put bread in a very special place, but we don't mostly eat bread anymore.
By the way, this thing costs a mere what? What is it exactly? How much does this book cost? These books cost?
Oh, the list price is $625.
Now, to show how I have no idea what I'm talking about, which most listeners know, I was going to say nobody's buying this for $625 until I read that Modernist Cuisine, which was your other expensive, huge book, is in its fourth printing, fifth printing, something like that?
I think it's sixth, actually.
So who's the audience for this, Nathan?
Well, as I said, people who are passionate and curious about food. When my book first came out, the first book, people said, oh, well, this is only for a very small set of high-end chefs. And then I'd say, well, that attitude that things have to be dumbed down for most people, I just disagree with. I would say, look online at all of the blogs of average people at home who bought the book and they're cooking with sous vide or they're doing other kinds of things.
What
out
is
of the
sous vide?
Book.
Tell people what that means.
Oh, sous vide is a cooking method where you cook at low temperature using a water bath. This is not, by the way, something that is good for bread. Bread really needs a hot oven. But for sous vide, if you wanted to cook, say, a steak, and you want to make it medium rare. Medium rare in a steak is about 130 degrees Fahrenheit. Well, you would cook with water that was like 132 degrees Fahrenheit, so just above the temperature of the steak, and that way it doesn't overcook.
By the way,
did you ever hear of that? I never heard of that.
I've heard of sous vide, but isn't Jose Andres part of that movement? One of your
yes,
buddies as well?
Yep.
And who's a very good friend of Donald Trump's, as we know. That's a joke for those who don't know. You know, I mentioned, Nathan, earlier on, in your former life, you were the chief technology person at Microsoft, correct?
Yes.
And I read that a guy, I assume a few people in the audience have heard of this guy, Bill Gates, came over for his birthday for a special meal. Gates, from afar to me, looks rather emaciated. I don't know about how you felt about it. Your former colleague.
He'd be very happy to hear that.
What did you cook for Bill Gates, and what is he like?
Well, I've worked for or with Bill most of my adult life, so I'm a big fan. We typically, when Bill has come over, we've cooked a 12 to 15 course dinner, all very unusual, different things along the line of modernist cuisine.
Give us a sample or two of a couple of those courses that we might not have in our typical day.
Oh, one of my favorite things, actually, is we take peas, actually frozen Jolly Green Giant peas, and grind them up into a goo, raw. Then we take that goo and we put it into a centrifuge, which is the scientific piece of scientific equipment. It spins it super fast. And it, you know how orange juice will like settle out in your fridge and you get this layer at the bottom? Well, it does that, but it does it way more powerfully than your fridge because when it spins around, it gets a force that's like 40,000 times Earth normal gravity. Well, it makes this pea broth that's this clear green broth. It also makes a bunch of starch, which we don't do much with. But it also makes a layer of the pea flavor chemicals, and we call it pea butter because it's got a texture of soft butter, but it has no fat in it. Oh my God, is it delicious.
Is it great?
Boy, does it ever sound delicious.
I also read in one of these pieces about deconstructed cocktails, like you have a deconstructed Bloody Mary. What does that mean?
Well, the idea, Ferran Adrià, a chef in Spain, came up with this idea of a deconstructed dish. And what he means by that is a dish where you've taken the flavors of something very familiar, flavors and ingredients, and you've presented them in a very unusual way. And then the question is, do you recognize the familiar thing in an unfamiliar context? So we've made a bunch of deconstructed cocktails. My favorite one is a cocktail that lacks one ingredient found in all other cocktails.
Liquor?
No, this one, to be a cocktail, I think you do have to have alcohol. Water.
Wow.
So we take basil and we pressure cook the basil in pure alcohol. And it turns this intense green color. And then we have a glass that has olive oil. And so it's olive oil and the pure alcohol with the basil extract and a couple crystals of salt on it.
Can I tell you something about
you? You put salt on wine, which I love.
Wait. We're running low on time. I just want to say.
So little time.
The books, I was just flipping through volume 3.
It's gorgeous.
First of all, is there one photographer or a multitude of photographers? They're just so beautiful.
Well, we have a photo team because we have lots of different photos that we take. I take a lot of the pictures.
Beautiful.
And I pick every picture. But we also have Chris and Duncan are the two other guys on the photo team. And,
you know what's great about you, I should say, we don't know you until today, Nathan Myhrvold, but your voice totally changes when you're describing the food. No, in the most reverential sort of way. When you were describing that pea concoction a second ago, you should listen to the tape afterwards. It was absolutely beautiful, as is this book. Congratulations.
I love this picture of the minestrone soup with the rays coming out from the side.
Well, when I say the book is for people who are passionate and curious about food, it did start with me being passionate
it's pretty
and
obvious.
Curious about food.
Well, we read, you said, did you say your mother when you were 9 that you wanted to cook the whole Thanksgiving meal?
Yep.
There it was.
That was my first big dinner to cook.
So you're having a lot of fun, obviously.
Well, if I'm not, it's my own damn fault.
We were talking to author and chef Nathan Myhrvold about his cookbook, Modernist Bread, The Art and Science. Coming up, we continue our conversations about food with Chef Marcus Samuelson. He is next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We're replaying some of our favorite conversations today with a focus on food, cooking, and food culture. Last year, just before the world went into a coronavirus lockdown, Marcus Samuelson joined us at GBH to talk about season 2 of his PBS TV series, No Passport Required. He also has a new cookbook titled The Rise, Black Cooks and the Soul of American Food. In his TV series, No Passport Required, Marcus Samuelson takes us around the world by way of American cities and the cuisine that's central to immigrant communities. Season 2 includes a spin through Cape Verde, Brazil, Portugal, using Boston as a port of entry.
I didn't know that the diaspora of Portuguese, Brazil, and Cape Verde had such a big imprint in Boston. And the food really preserves the stories between these three communities.
If you represent the Portuguese culture, it's seafood.
When I eat a dish like this, I taste West Africa, but not with the pork. That's the Portuguese influence.
Woo! You can catch season 2 of No Passport Required right here online at pbs.org. Marcus is an award-winning chef, restaurateur, cookbook author, and of course the host of No Passport Required. Welcome to Boston Public Radio. Great to meet you, Marcus.
Thank you for having me. Very excited to be here.
Well, thank you very much for coming in. So as Jim just said, you're a renowned chef. You had all these restaurants all over the place. But how did that translate into No Passport Required? How'd this start?
Well, I think we're at a pivotal moment right now, right? In this moment in the country, but also as an American, as an immigrant American, I felt like, how can we put content out there that actually talks about our complexity and our beauty as a country? And I think food and immigration is one of the most delicious ways to celebrate America. But it was really the core of like showing America is beautiful, it's deeply complex, and every layer of immigrants have added something new to it, and it's special. And, you know, when you think about the Portuguese, Cape Verdean, and Brazilian, that's like three different communities that sometimes doesn't, you know, get heard. And this was a great opportunity to present that in Boston.
You know, you I think you touched on, without going as far as I would have gone, having watched your show, this is the right time for this. I mean, yeah. At the same time, we're listening to a speech last night that had a lot of anti-immigrant rhetoric. Yeah. People are looking for a safe harbor. Yeah. And your show is that harbor, don't you think?
It's a starting point. It's something to have dinner around and invite people in from a different culture that may or may not know about you. But, you know, for me, it's really about, you know, you come as an Ethiopian or you come as a Swede. And for me, I just look at, like, so many people don't know what does Sweden taste like, what does Ethiopia taste like.
I have no idea.
And so some of the best way to explain that for you is actually, let me cook for you, right? So just that simple idea of presenting your identity through food has been around forever. And, yeah, I mean, I feel bad for people that have so much fear around of us. You know, immigrants are some of the most hardest working people you will ever find. And we're Americans. We're here to add value, and we're extremely patriotic. That's the other side of this that comes out. Like, immigrants are some of the most patriotic people you will ever find.
Well, you are you're Swedish via Ethiopia, right?
Yeah, I'm very confused.
And so, but you think about this. This is a hot country, Ethiopia, going to a freezing cold country.
Yeah.
So what was it like for you when you were still in Sweden with the Ethiopian food?
Yeah. You know, me and my sister, we got adopted. So we really grew up in Sweden. I didn't really find out more about my Ethiopian culture into my early 20s. So Sweden is really the country and the culture that I grew up in. So I'm more a herring and a meatball guy. But I became a Dora Watt and Injera guy, right? And that's we can all do that. And I think that is finding all of these incredible stories that we all have, that we all share. Some are more notable. We know more about Italian-American food than we know about something else. But with no passport for us, it's really about doing a great portrait to this beautiful city that we go to, but also highlighting the immigrant culture that might even be hidden for people who live in that city.
Yeah, I want you, speaking of living in that city, Marjorie's from Fall River. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I live in Cambridge, both of which you visited in the current edition.
Yeah,
before we get that, I want you to know, we've been doing the radio show for 20 years. No one has ever come in our studio, Marcus, with two different plaid things on. I've never seen one. I'm staring at you. How would you describe what you're wearing, the shirt and pants combo?
I bought the green from Boston. I bought my little green. I told my wife, I got to wear green. You know, I'm going up to Boston.
And the red plaid
the
pants.
He's a man of the world. Yeah, watch a little bit of this, a little bit of that, put it all out together.
So I was really worried when I was watching the Boston show. Well, it's Boston and Eastern Massachusetts. Yes, you're in New Bedford, you're Fall River. I was really worried because I got to watch it before Marjorie did. What happens when Marjorie, who's from Fall River, had not been to Portugalia Market? And I say to her, Marjorie, do you at least know what it is? What'd you say to me?
I was just there like a week ago.
I love it.
Well, it is great because it's got, as you point out, well, the fish thing, I didn't even know about because I'm not really big on fish, whether
you're
it's salted fish
person,
or not. But it's got Portuguese wines and Portuguese sweetbread. And in Fall River, a lot of the people came from St. Michael's in the Azores, and they got all these cheeses from the Azores.
Exactly.
And so it's an incredible. Tell us
about
Portugalia.
But also what it tells us, it's also a family business, right?
Yes.
It started with one vision and dream, and now the family is running it, the younger generation is running it, and you don't have to be Portuguese. You could be, but you just, you like really good produce and product. It's all there, right? From Portuguese design to Portuguese olive oil to sardines and bacalhau, you know what I mean? So it just shows you how something has evolved, right? And the Portuguese community, you could be Cape Verdean and there's food that sort of you relate to. You could be Brazilian. So it's a much larger conversation than people think.
Yeah, that's true. Everybody in Portuguese, in Brazil speaks Portuguese.
Yes. Fala português.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I'm going to try to say, I'm glad you said bacalhau. Is that how you say it?
Bacalhau, yeah.
Okay. So when you ask the father, that's a father-son combo. I love that part of this, by the way. You mentioned the family thing. It only started, what do you say, in 88? It's relatively.
In a garage.
In their garage. I forgot about that. You asked them how long the salted cod, I think, would last. And we've all seen it in different markets, maybe not in the quantity that we saw it at this market. What did he say to you?
Well, you know, the salted cod, it can last up for years, right? And it's really
on a shelf?
Yes, because it comes out of necessity. We almost lost our lines into why people cured stuff, right? Because refrigeration, we take that for granted. So it went from a preserving technique, a necessity, to a flavor enhancer. That's what it is today. You use a little bit of that bacalhau, and you make those cod fritters or crab fritters that are so delicious, but you need a little bit of that saltiness. And hey, I grew up in Sweden. Lutfisk is the same thing. You bury that fish with cod, you pick it up a year later, and off you go.
So let's travel from the hometown of Mardrig into my adopted hometown, Cambridge. Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Here you are visiting Moqueca, which I've been to, by the way. This incredible Brazilian restaurant. It's in Inman Square, where I live. Yeah. Here's Marcus's conversation with the owner.
When most people think about Cambridge, maybe they think about world-class universities. For me, as a chef, I think about this little restaurant called Moqueca. So today I'm meeting Chef Fafa, but I've heard about this dish called feijoada.
Everyone knows feijoada, because feijoada we have all over Brazil.
You're here between MIT and Harvard and run this successful restaurant for 19 years. Well, you made a life for yourself, and it's meaningful. You bring the community together.
Yeah.
You talk in all of the interviews and all the experiences, all the meals you have in this Boston. And I hate to just focus on the Boston thing, but it is us.
So
is you talk about the interrelationship between the Cape Verdeans, the Brazilians, the Portuguese, and that was evident here too. Yeah. Yes,
sometimes the history, any country's history, it can be ugly, it can be difficult to talk about, but food is a way to celebrate it and get everybody around the table, right? But also, what I think is so important with the show is that It's America's collective of families, dreams, sometimes small businesses. And you look at Moqueca, it's a great example of that. She came with a vision and a dream. She fought really hard to keep her dream alive. She's been open for 19 years. Uh-huh. And it put food on the table, sent family to colleges and stuff like that. Sometimes when you just drive by, you see these like endless malls with just names. Moqueca it's a small business that kept the light on. It's not about branding. This is family. This is real America. And for immigrants, very often food is the first industry we can enter into and make us be part of the larger community.
We're talking to Marcus Samuelson. Season 2 of The Great No Passport Required on PBS, I should say, has recently begun.
So you went to Houston,
yes,
and talked about the Nigerian, Senegalese, and Liberian communities there. So what's some of the things about their food?
Well, you know, Houston, first of all, is the most diverse city in the country. And
I
think those are great surprises, right?
Yeah.
We might not think about Texas as a super diverse place. It is. And then how did the
Unlike Iowa, by the way, if you're comparing, I want to be clear, guys.
Yes. So Houston has had this tradition with Nigerian community for a long time. Started with universities, started with oil, and now their food is being part of, like, we know there's great Vietnamese food in Houston, but it's amazing West African food. So I had to, for the very first time, I had to eat fufu with fish stew, and I had to learn in a different eat in a different way, and I loved it. It was so much fun.
How did you get to be a chef, being growing up in Sweden, being adopted from Ethiopia? What did this happen? Were you like making good cheese and eggs in fifth grade or something like that?
I have to tell you, I love my grandmother, but she was also very much pro child labor. Me and my sister, bless her heart. If you came to her house, you had to eat. We ate very well, but it was a clear choice.
Yeah.
You go up to grandma's house, you're working. There was always something that had to be done, right? You know, pickling beets, going apple picking, rolling meatballs, making bread. So literally, I loved it. My sister, not so much, but I loved it. And then I got a scholarship very, very young in Sweden. I got a chance to go to Japan very early in my career. And, just been cooking ever since.
So, Marcus, Marjorie asked how you got started with the show. How'd you get started cooking? How'd you get the job to do Obama's first state dinner? Did you know the Obamas beforehand?
Well, you know, the good thing about that is I don't think I'm going to get the call now.
What?
So I don't have to worry about that. But the first, just saying, but the Obama's first date dinner was absolutely amazing. It was one of those things that I was so nervous before. And, you know, I called my mom from the White House. I called my mom, you have no idea where I'm at right now, what I'm going to do tonight.
Oh, gosh.
I'm at the White House. I'm going to cook the steak dinner. This is my mother. He's like, listen, do not embarrass the family. If you can leave, there's still time to leave. If you leave now, it might not be good for you, but it's better than embarrass your father's name.
But how did it come about? Did you have a connection, or did he know? You know, they know of you, or what was the connection?
It was about 20 chefs in the country that you could bid. You know, can really come up with a suggestion of food, and because of the first lady at the time, Michelle Obama started her amazing garden project.
Sure,
and the state. Dinner was for Mr. Singh that was vegetarian. So my suggestion was really around vegetarian food, a vegetarian forward food. And they really liked it. And then there was a tasting, and then there was another tasting, and eventually I got the job.
So you mentioned nervousness, but I hope you weren't joking. My anxiety level, if I were, I mean, I can't cook, but beyond that, even if I could, were you not ready to have your head pop off with anxiety about what the reaction was going to be? Or are you a calm sort of soul?
I thought about it as, to do one of these like big weddings out in the Hamptons or Nantucket or something like that. This is like a big wedding. Just focus on that. And I've done that so many times. So because if I'm nervous, the 30 or 40 cooks that I was leading at the time would have been nervous too. So it's about, all right, Marcus, like you have a job to do, now do it. And it was a lot of fun. And the best memory about everything was after the state dinner, the Obamas were kind enough to, this is after shaking 400 people's hands, by the way, come back in the kitchen.
Oh, man.
And talk to all the cooks and the dishwashers, shake their hands, and really make it something that obviously they would never forget the day anyway, but that will never forget that they took time and really talked to us.
You know, one more thing about a state dinner. You mentioned that, you know, you have the tastings and the tastings. So long before you're actually going to go there, you know everything that's going to be served that night.
Yeah.
And do you negotiate it at all? Or, I mean, you mentioned the vegetarian dishes, but if somebody wanted, you know, a steak, I mean, do you have to do a bunch of different things or what?
That. You know, next one time I'm going to do a steak dinner, are you going to come with me?
Absolutely.
And we're going to do it together. No, there's a lot of back and forth.
Yeah.
But there's so many different logistics. Safety is number one. Number one.
I mean, in terms of alert allergies.
All aspects. Yeah. All aspects of that. So it's a lot of negotiating back and forth. But it has to be delicious. And it has to be about breaking bread. Right? So food can also signal a lot of stuff. At that dinner, we served cornbread. But we also served chapatis. We served collard greens. But we also served a curry dish. So you can signal sort of like Americana and India at the same time at a dinner.
And do they have the state-of-the-art equipment in the White House?
Here she goes.
Or is it a little bit, you know, passe?
And did you steal any ashtrays? I mean, let's get down to it, Marcus.
I love that. Are you going to do inventory with me?
Well, no, I just wonder. Yeah. I figure they've got the latest in all the cooking accoutrements, but maybe they don't.
It was a good kitchen.
It was a good kitchen.
It was good times.
Okay.
Yes.
So where'd you go? Where are the I know you went to Philly, my original hometown. Yeah. You were in Las Vegas. Where are you in season
two?
So
in Philly, we did Italian-American food, going to South Street, to the Italian market, the oldest market, open-air market in America.
Wow.
In Las Vegas, it's going to be Chinese-American culture. You know, I don't think we would be anywhere without Chinese immigrant culture into this country in terms of food. I think the Chinese and the Mexican Italians, probably the three immigrant culture that added the most to the American food scene. Then in Los Angeles, Armenia, we did an Armenian episode, which was unbelievable. This tiny country has such a rich history. And then we started off at Seattle with Filipino culture.
So are you the inevitable comparison? I'm sure you've had to deal with this about 1,000 times, is with the late legendary Anthony Bourdain. He was with us once, and I have to say we were all so smitten. But you do, I hope you take this, okay, since I think he was the master of this craft, you do a variation of theme. Your ability through food to introduce us to culture in ways that I think if we were getting a TED Talk or a lecture would never work. But you are Bourdain-esque. Are you okay with that? Or
Anthony was a big mentor for me. And
oh, really?
We traveled together. I took him back to my home country in Ethiopia. Mm. We cooked together. And, you know, this appetite for long storytelling about food wouldn't be here without people like Anthony Bourdain, without the Beard Foundation, without things like PBS that actually, you know, with Julia and Jacques really started to introduce food to America in a different way. But Anthony, the way he told stories, nobody's going to be able to, you know, fill that void again. But all we can do is to really honor him by doing really good food storytelling.
Speaking of good food and good food storytelling, you mentioned the Beard Foundation. You won a Beard Award. Were you like 11 or how old were you? I'm serious.
Yeah,
you were a kid,
young.
Weren't you?
Yeah, that's
how does that change? How does that change your life?
It's one of these things that you party and you have a good time, and then I put it away, right? Because I don't want any of this stuff. I have it in a drawer. Because my grandmother would still say to me, this doesn't mean you can cook. This doesn't mean that you can cook. And she would like, you know, like, so. But I love it for the team, and it's acknowledged all the work and all of that stuff. But as a creative person, you got to put that stuff away because you still got to keep your eye on what matters. And that's really about delicious food and learning more about it.
What happened to your sister? Did she become a lawyer?
She's in Sweden.
Okay.
She would love you for saying that. You know, like, yeah,
it just didn't do it for her. The cooking.
No,
just
cooking
didn't,
not. Yeah. But she loves to eat, and every summer we stay at our house together for a week and we cook. And she still thinks she's a better cook than me. And I'm gonna she can win that one.
We'll send her a tape. Where is good Swedish food on the East Coast?
Oh my God.
I'm trying to think. I think I've eaten every ethnic. Yeah. There's a great Ethiopian restaurant in Central Square in Cambridge, actually.
Ethiopian coffee is so delicious.
But is there a great Swedish restaurant?
You got to go to New York. You have a restaurant, Aquavit, where I started cooking.
Of course, that's right.
It's a great Swedish restaurant. But again, Scandinavian food is delicious, but it's hard to find.
And why is that? I mean, in light of the fact that there is such an appetite, a horrible pun, for food from different parts of the world.
Food travels in a couple of ways, right? Massive population like China and India, yeah, or massive immigration, yeah, let's say in Mexico or South America. And Sweden has a small population and also not a huge immigrant population, right? So it's hard kind of to get out of it, you know. Now people can argue that, you know, there is that furniture store that sells Swedish food.
That's right.
But that's not Swedish food.
The meatballs are not, they're not real Swedish food, no, from IKEA.
Did you ever find any meat in the meatballs? Because that's a question that if you find the meat in the meatball, call me.
Yeah, we are talking about IKEA, yeah, where people go, Jim spent hours.
I love those Swedish meatballs.
Yeah.
You know, Marcus, before we go, do you mind if I give you a little advice?
Yes.
I would suggest, I mean, you're wildly successful, I know that. If you could find a plaid jacket to go with the rest of the look, I think you have really, really got
that's
it made.
It.
He's fashion forward.
I say that with love. I hope you know
thank
that.
You. Appreciate okay. that.
He's very
appreciate
daring.
That.
He's very daring. We were talking to Chef Marcus Samuelson about season 2 of his PBS TV series, No Passport Required. He also has a new cookbook titled The Rise, Black Cooks and the Soul of American Food. Coming up, we continue our conversations about food and cooking with Andrew Lee and Irene Lee and their cookbook about Chinese cooking. They're next on 89.7 GBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Today we're replaying some of our favorite conversations about food, food culture, and cooking, which included the one we had with restaurateurs Andrew Lee and Irene Lee. They joined us to talk about their cookbook, which they wrote with their sister Margaret Lee, titled Double Awesome Chinese Food, Irresistible and Totally Achievable Recipes from Our Chinese American Kitchen.
Well, congratulations. It is an absolutely beautiful cookbook, and I'm so excited because I've discovered you are right. I should have known this before, like dope like I am. You're right on my route home. So.
How'd you discover that, Margaret?
You told me.
Because last week, I didn't know you were coming. I had every kind of dumpling and fritter. And let me tell you something. Those, whatever that is, that smoked blue, is it a smoked bluefish fritter?
It is.
It's one of the best things I have ever popped in my mouth.
Oh, I'm so glad
it
to hear that.
It is spectacular. So it's great to meet you guys.
So both. This is a very heartwarming story because some siblings really want to, you know, kill each other. But you guys, three of you, have gone into business together. So how did this
you
happen?
Can be both.
You can be both. But you look so happy in the pictures.
That's true.
How did this come about? Either one of you could tell me.
So I have been working in restaurants for quite some time, and I discovered quite by accident, actually, that my two sisters had been writing a food blog about their various adventures, doing rambling restaurants. Irene lived on a farm for some time, and I discovered that their passion for food exceeded or matched any of the people that I'd worked with in the industry, and I said, let's do something together. So we all came back to Boston. We started our food truck, and that was about 7 years ago. And, as you mentioned, working with your siblings is both a blessing and a curse.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have done it any other way, and I'm just so proud of them.
But you talk in the book, Irene, about, cousins, aunts, uncles, how food was such a part of your childhood. And these, I can envision these huge, happy gatherings of relatives. It's partly that, too.
Yeah. I think, the dinner table was always sort of the center of our household growing up. So if dad was working and mom, of course, was also working and we were out in the afternoon, it didn't matter what you were doing. Everybody had to be at the table at 6 p.m. And then, of course, when you bring all the other family members into the mix, we come from a big Chinese family on both sides. We would hang out for a reunion, and it was always eating lunch, talking about what are we going to eat for dinner, and then being at dinner talking about what's for breakfast tomorrow. So I think for us, everything in family life really revolves around food and the table.
You know, I have to say, I don't know if it was you, Irene, or your sister, but you, whoever it is, you and I have a lot in common. I read a story where your mother went away one time, exact same thing happened to me, and I butchered a pig, which is exactly what one of you did.
Yeah,
was you?
Yeah.
How did that come about? That's not true in my case. How did that come about in your life?
Well, from my experience with farming, one of the things that I feel really strongly about is how animals are raised. Uh-huh. And we knew that we wanted to serve meat only from animals that had gotten to live at least some of their lives outside, which is not how the majority of farm animals are actually raised in this country. So in order to afford pasture-raised meat or pasture-raised pork, we knew that we were going to have to buy the whole animal from the farmer so that we could get a whole pig for $3 a pound instead of pork chops for $18 mm-hmm. a pound. And so I did what any good millennial does. I went to the internet, and so we watched lots of YouTube videos, we read lots of books, and I went to the SOA Farmers Market and just picked the friendliest seeming farmer I could find and asked if they would deliver
right
a pig.
SOA right down the street here you're talking about?
Yeah.
And that's how you ended up with the pig that you butchered?
Yeah, it all happened so fast.
That is, how'd that go?
It was really fun. I think, it teaches you that there's so much more to raising animals and preparing meat than picking it out in the grocery store.
Yeah.
You start to get this whole perspective about where different cuts come from and why it's so important to use every part of the animal. That's a phrase that you hear more and more, but it's because the animal has lots of parts that aren't a tenderloin or a pork chop or pork belly that you can make into bacon. It's, there's a whole lot going on there.
But also, speaking of just to continue that note, you guys are big-time anti-waste people. You have that great site. What's the name of that site? What's that site?
Yeah, the site is called foodwastefeast.com, and our sister is really the driver behind that. But it's sort of all about how to take some tips from professional kitchens and to use those at home to make sure you really get to make the most of all the groceries you buy.
You know what's the best part of that, by the way? I was telling Marjorie this morning, and again, I knew about this before I knew you guys were coming. You can type in the thing that you're worried about going by, and it tells you, like I typed in kale about a week ago or something.
There's lots of kale
and it tells
on the
you what to do with the kale before you have to toss it, which is really... what's the name of the site again one more time?
Food Waste Feast.
Feast, that's right.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Was that the thing that talked about how you put vegetables that you think are like maybe a little bit past their prime, you freeze them, and then you cook them all like for stock?
Yeah, you can do so many different things with them.
I didn't even know you could freeze vegetables. I mean, I didn't know, especially like greens, but you can?
Yeah, I mean, you can really freeze anything, and it depends what you want to do with it later. So if the texture isn't a big issue, like if you're making stock, you can throw anything in the freezer. So May, our sister, we call her May, Margaret, she keeps a stock bag in the freezer, and so every time she has a little bit of onion scrap or the butt of a head of celery, it all goes into the bag, and then when it's time to make stock, everything comes out and goes in the pot.
And May, we should say, means little sister, for those who don't know, correct?
Correct, yeah. Okay, so we've got Andy and his two Mamies.
He does. Now, one last thing before we talk about the cookbook, which is beautiful, and you're hopefully going to tell
I
us
have a
that
couple of last
mere
things.
Mortals can do this. We talk about Jose Andres a lot on this show with people like Corby, who just left a couple of minutes ago. And for those who don't know, he's this guy who should win the Nobel Peace Prize for the wonderful work he did in Puerto Rico and the pop-up kitchen for the federal workers in Washington. He's done a whole bunch of things, and some people like Margie love that he threatened to sue Donald Trump. That makes her happy. You were part of the Chefs for Feds thing here. Were you guys not? Yeah.
Yes, we were.
What'd you do?
So we offered basically $15 off a meal for anyone who showed a federal ID during a certain period of the day. And we do a lot of work around food insecurity and hunger in the city of Boston. And so it seemed like a natural fit for us to make sure that we were participating in this effort. And I actually went to a meeting of some federal workers convened by Ayanna Pressley just to hear their stories and to really learn more about the human impact of what was going on with the shutdown. And I think that made all of us feel like we were so happy we were doing any small part to really try and improve things for
good
those
for
folks.
You guys.
Because so
that's
many
great.
Of these people were out of money really quickly.
Yeah, and
yeah,
I think
it was amazing.
Yeah, it was really heartbreaking. Not just that they were out of money, but the sense of betrayal that you could feel. And so, you know, when anyone has a loss, the only thing I know how to do is feed them. So that was really what we were going for.
We're talking to Andrew Lee and Irene Lee, and the cookbook is Double Awesome Chinese Food, which are going to irresistible and totally achievable recipes from our Chinese American kitchen. The restaurant, of course, is Maymay. We're going to talk about the book in a second, but just a couple more things. You mentioned millennials being concerned about where the animals come from, and I've heard that, you know, from my kids. They're also worried about this kind of thing. They're also worried about the farm-to-table stuff and local farming. You talk about urban farming. I know what local sourcing is and farm-to-table is. What's urban farming?
So urban farming is something that has been around for a long time. Our favorite urban farm is the Food Project in Roxbury and Dorchester. And basically, they take pieces of land that are sort of abandoned, and they develop them into these extremely densely packed, very fruitful, so to speak, farms that are producing food for the people who live in that neighborhood to supply farmers markets. And there's all sorts of community building work, as you can imagine, that goes into creating a piece of land like that and then nurturing it over the years.
We should say, by the way, we didn't mention where the restaurant is. Did we mention where the restaurant is? It's on Park Drive, by the way. Right?
It is.
It's on Park, was it 500 and something?
It's 506 Park Drive. It's right behind where the Elephant Walk used to
of
be.
Course,
and
right.
We've got a bright yellow awning and a little parklet in the front.
Okay, right. So the critical issue here, Andrew, for people like me and Marjorie, are the two words in your subtitle, totally achievable. If you don't know, I always rate myself like a C-plus cook. Marjorie knows how to make one dish, prune chicken. That's about
the... Actually, I would say you're a B-minus.
Well, thank you. That's actually very nice. So how much... Like Mapo... My kids are Chinese, by the way. And my older daughter's favorite food in the world is Mapo tofu. It's your second recipe. Can I make... Andrew, can I... And be honest. As somebody who has minimal skills, despite Marjorie's kindness, can I make a successful Mapo tofu from this cookbook?
100%, absolutely.
Why do you say that?
So the structure of the cookbook is really that it starts with stuff like the sauces. You put together a few things. It's nothing overwhelming. And, you know, you build your confidence from there. And before you know it, you're, you know, cooking Peking duck or whatever it is. And, you know, you're... stepping up the game.
Confidence is a huge... I mean, is it not a huge part of being a... I mean, you really have to go over that threshold to believe you can even do this kind of stuff,
you know,
right?
It's one of those things. If you try to start with the bigger recipes, then you're talking about potentially a very costly, you know, if you overcook something or if something goes wrong, then, you know, if you have to throw out the whole thing or you don't get it to where, you know, you want it to be, then, you know, you may not try again if you have to spend, you know, a bunch of money on ingredients.
So make a recommendation as to what I should make this weekend. What should my first item be from this that will build my confidence so I can go to the more difficult
stuff?
You know,
the sauces are very versatile. You know, you can start with that and you can put it on anything you want. And those are very, very approachable.
You know what else? And this is another thing. I mean, I'm not really much of a foodie, so I'm kind of behind the trends. I know it's been around for a while. But the whole thing with food and bowls. I mean, you've got a million recipes about food and bowls. The soy ginger noodle salad with pickled carrots and tofu, the picture's so beautiful. It looks great. What is it with the food and bowls?
Well, I think we've seen food and bowls sort of become this trend that you can get out in the world, like at Sweetgreen or Dig In. But the truth
right
is,
the street,
there
both
you go.
Of them,
yeah.
I should say, yeah,
I think the truth is that we've been eating food in bowls forever, and that's really what I think homestyle food is about. You're not necessarily making a big multi-course affair every night. You're maybe cooking one thing that's fresh, digging something else out of the freezer, something else in the fridge that you don't want to go bad, and you just combine it all in a bowl. And that's really sort of the first part of thinking about how to create a meal.
But you know what? There's something to it. Marjorie, of course, doesn't remember this.
The
we did a whole
thing.
Show
yes, I do.
A year or so ago. I eat all my meals out of a bowl. And it's not just, for, I mean, the reasons you state are important ones. But there's also something about eating out of a bowl. Do you get it? Or do you, I mean, does it, what is it? I'm not even sure what it is. I just know I love it and it feels different. What is it?
You know, for me, eating out of a bowl means you can mix everything up.
Maybe
and
that's
you know
it.
You get it, you get a you can mix it up, you know, and you get a little bite of everything, you know, with each bite you take. So that's one thing that I've always thought of.
Yeah, something warm and comforting about eating out of a bowl.
How hard's the restaurant business in 2019? We have a lot of restaurateurs here, and they talk about how hard it is to get decent staff. There's a huge amount of competition. We talk almost every week about somebody's favorite restaurant shutting down in greater Boston, some of which have been here forever. How hard is it to stay afloat in 2019? I mean, you have the celebrated food truck, obviously, plus the thing on Park Drive. How hard is it, Irene?
The industry is really challenging, and I think there's so many things that I learned on the job about how challenging it is. One thing that not a lot of people know is that we rely on catering for a huge percentage of our revenue. So in addition to running the restaurant, we have the food truck, we do weddings, we do drop-off catering, we do staffed events, birthday parties, dumpling classes, all sorts of stuff. And we do that mainly because it's a way for us to supplement the revenue from the restaurant. And in addition to that, last year we took on a program of open book management, which basically involves teaching everybody on the staff how to understand restaurant finance. So every 4 weeks...
Including your own restaurant's finance?
Especially our own restaurant's
so
finance.
So the people who work for you know all about how you're doing or not doing?
They do. So we create an annual plan at the end of every year for the following year. And then every 4 weeks we meet and review the entire profit and loss statement and see how we're doing according to plan. So we worked with a small consulting group in Boston called Rethink Restaurants. They have a handful of clients in the city and in the surrounding neighborhoods. And this is something that I personally think is really going to change the way the restaurant industry works, because increasingly restaurant staff are, you know, millennials with college debt, and they want to learn and they want to advance, and they don't want to slave away under some angry French chef forever. And so for us to be able to give them an opportunity to actually learn something about the business and finance, it's really exciting.
You know, this is the longest anybody's ever been here.
Yeah.
Who brought
we
food.
Know. We want to know.
What did you bring?
What is there to,
let's
what did you
eat.
Bring us to eat? Yeah, we have
it,
to have a bite
Andrew?
Of this.
So what we have for you today is our double awesome scallion pancake sandwich.
Ooh.
And
ooh.
It is a slow poached, then fried oozy egg.
Oh, my God.
On
thank
a
you.
You're gonna need the napkin.
Grilled scallion pancake. It has a house-made greens pesto. Very simple. Just basically just pureed greens and a little bit of olive oil, some garlic and salt, a little bit of vinegar. And then on the side, you have some sriracha ketchup.
Okay. Jim, do you have a bite?
I am eating.
We can't have a bite at the same time. While you're having a bite, I'm going to say, because it's rude to talk with your mouth full on the radio, we're talking
about
Irene
that.
Lee and Andrew Lee, and the cookbook is Double Awesome Chinese Food, Irresistible and Totally Achievable Recipes from Our Chinese-American Kitchen with absolutely gorgeous pictures. You know what's great about this? I'll know what to order by how it looks in the pictures.
There you go.
Can we get back to what I just ate now that I've swallowed it? This is fab. What is this thing? What is it? I know it's a scallion pancake. And by the way, the scallion pancake is fabulous. Forget what's inside of it. What's inside of it again? Either of you guys? Andrew, Irene, what is it?
So we have a slow poached and then fried egg. All of our eggs come from one farm in Providence, Rhode Island, from Don Buffoni.
Really?
We're hoping that we're putting like one of his kids through college or something like that. We
farm
serve a lot of eggs.
In Providence?
Yeah, right outside of Providence. They
wow.
have two locations. But we also have in there a local greens pesto, so just a green sauce, really.
It's delicious.
And some melted cheddar cheese. So in a lot of ways, it's kind of an amped up breakfast sandwich, but we sell them all day long. And at the restaurant, you can get it with bacon or ham. I think bacon's probably our favorite, right? Don't tell ham, but yeah.
Now, by the way, you guys don't know Marjorie. I obviously have known her for a long time. And when we have somebody in who brings food, Marjorie always tries to be nice, even if she can't stand what it is. I can tell by the look on her
face.
I love this. This is one happy woman right now.
Some people bring me exotic things, like, you know, with anchovies or fish that I don't like very much. So did you guys...
Isn't that... But what do you think of that?
It's delicious.
It is really delicious.
No, I know I'm going to love this. I like the eating in the bowls thing. I like that a lot. I'm very excited about that. So did you learn this? Was your mom and dad, were they great cooks? I mean, is that how you got into this whole thing?
That's actually a great question. Our grandmother on our father's side, she actually owned a restaurant in White Plains, New York.
Oh, really? Oh,
and it was one of the larger Chinese restaurants in that community. And yes.
Irene is holding up the photo.
That's pretty great. What page is that? I want to look in my own book.
It is page 28.
Thank you all very right. much.
So the interesting about her is she told all of her children...
Gosh.
That she didn't want them to go through the restaurant industry. And they all have PhDs. Now, the restaurant bug, if you will, skipped a generation. So now we have us as siblings in the restaurant industry. And we're not sure where the next generation is going. But that's very much the genesis of, you know, where our passion for restaurants. And again, as Irene mentioned before, bringing people together with food has come from.
How do you think this, how is this book, I assume when you're deciding how to craft this thing, you say, we got to do something that we can credibly say is different from another Asian cookbook that's good. How is this different? What separates this from another Asian cookbook that is on my shelf, and I've got plenty? What's the difference?
Yeah, I mean, there are tons of incredible Asian cookbooks out there. And I think for us, this is really centered here in New England and the Northeast. And so you're going to see a lot of ingredients that aren't classic to Chinese or other Asian cuisines, like maple syrup, cranberries. We talk a lot about how we shop and how we think about ingredients. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I prefer not to call our food fusion because that makes it sound like it was made in a lab.
I was about to say that. I'm really glad I didn't. Go
ahead. I think scientists make Asian fusion, but we are just three Chinese American kids who grew up in Boston. And, you know, we didn't set out to make weird fusion food. We just kind of were scrounging in the fridge and the freezer. And this is exactly the kind of thing that we would put together in our own home.
Can I ask a question about where Marjorie started? Last night we did a panel with the three guys from This Old House. And I asked them a question about how, when they're fighting behind the scenes, how do they do their work? And the three of them, credibly, I think, said they never fight, which I find really hard to believe. How do I assume you have normal siblings kinds of thing. I'm serious about this. I mean, how hard is it, as much as you love them, and it's pretty clear by the look in your face when you're looking at your sister, how you feel about her, Andrew, how hard is it to do this with people you're this close to?
It's very challenging. Especially when your sisters are clearly more intelligent than you. there's no question there. You know, coming from different experiences, approaching things in a different way, at a certain point, you know, you have to be able to sacrifice things. And Irene has demonstrated her passion to the point where, you know, I personally defer to her more often than not. Mm. And, you know, I think that... That was important. That was an important jump for me personally. And, you know, I wouldn't have it any other way. There's always two right ways to do something or more than one right way to do something. So, you know, you can go with her way to do things, and she's the boss. That's just how
it
is.
Well, not only are you really grown up, I want you to know, while you're facing me answering and saying I defer to her, your sister is nodding in agreement.
Yeah, that's right. She wants
like,
you to defer to her.
Trying to be supportive. Like,
of
yeah,
the Lee
Andy,
family,
yeah.
Yes.
I'm actually wearing a pair of socks that my sister gave me that say, I'm not bossy. I'm the boss.
Oh, I love that. That's very good. Let me ask you a question, though, because I have looked at the pictures more than I've read, I must admit. Do you explain this whole concept of saving the food, the website you guys, the food waste feast thing, where you can put things away in the fridge and how to make? Because I would not know how to begin to do that. Is that something that's in here, or should I go to some website and find that out?
There's definitely material in the book about how to limit food waste and how to make sure you use all the different parts of the ingredients you're buying. Unfortunately, a lot of cookbooks, you know, they have to be very exact, and you know, they might not want you to say it could be kale or collard greens or bok choy or napa cabbage. And so I think we have some of that in here, and we're hoping that a next project will center more around that. And we definitely encourage you to visit Food Waste Feast.
We were talking with Andrew Lee and Irene Lee about their cookbook, which they wrote with their sister Margaret Lee. It's titled Double Awesome Chinese Food, Irresistible and Totally Achievable Recipes from Our Chinese-American Kitchen. Coming up, Christopher Kimball of Milk Street fame is here to talk about his new cookbook. Keep your dial on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. If you're just joining us, we're replaying some of our favorite conversations about cooking and food. We wrap things up with Christopher Kimball. He joined us earlier this year to talk about his latest cookbook, Tuesday Night's Mediterranean, 125 Simple Weeknight Recipes from the World's Healthiest Cuisine. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan and Jim Browdy. If you're ready to reboot your taste buds after a year of pandemic eating, and eager to cook your way back to healthier and more flavorful meals, Christopher Kimball and the James Beard Award-winning Milk Street team are there to help you with a new cookbook, Tuesday Night's Mediterranean is what it's called. Christopher Kimball is the founder of Milk Street, a food media company which produces Christopher Kimball's Milk Street magazine. He's also the host of Milk Street Radio and Milk Street TV. Christopher, congratulations on another great one, and welcome back.
My pleasure. How are you guys doing?
We're good.
Great.
Thank you.
Great to talk to you again, Christopher. So before we get to Tuesday Night's Mediterranean, another tour de force with the pictures. I just love the pictures. But anyway, before we get to that, I just want to congratulate you on Cookish, which was a huge bestseller and was part of it the other day, part of this great piece about how the pandemic, the cookbooks of 2020 tell the stories of our pandemic. And just quickly tell people, because my daughter and new son-in-law stole it when they went back to New York City. I was very upset. But they cooked a lot of your recipes from Cookish with just six ingredients. It was even great for someone like me who is not really much of a cook. But tell people briefly about Cookish before we get on to your new book.
Well, I think you want me to send you another copy first.
No, that's
okay.
Let's just be
clear what's going on here. These five and six ingredient cookbooks, I always used to make fun of them because it was like chicken breasts at 350 coated with mustard, you know, in the oven for an hour with some breadcrumbs. Yeah. So this was a six ingredient book, but the concept was, you know, using our travels around the world, put together sort of more interesting combinations of flavors and textures and do it in a way where you could substitute. So instead of following the recipe the same way every time, you know, instead of A, you could use B. And so yep. The concept was there, but you could improvise if you made it a second time. And the hope was people would cook eventually without recipes by keeping them simple.
You know, so getting back to this piece, the New York Times piece that your Cookish was included in, before we get to the latest, how has 13 months of this nightmare affected your end of the business and, in your estimation, the end of where the consumer or the cook or the eater is?
Well, it's a good question. And anybody who says they have the answers probably just lying to you. What I think has happened is the home is now much more of a focus and will continue to be, because a large number of people will be working out of their home part-time anyway, right? So more time in the home means more cooking. And I think the other thing I would say is, I think people who found cooking to be an inconvenience have now realized that it's less of an inconvenience than they thought. They've had no choice. People who liked to cook before now have realized cooking actually is fun to do. So I think people have stepped up to the next level a little bit. So I think as soon as we're out of lockdown, there'll be a lot of interest in going to restaurants and bars. But I think when that subsides, the home will continue to be a bigger portion of people's lives than it was pre-COVID.
No, but I want to talk more about the future in a minute, Christopher Kimball. But in terms of the 13 months we've lived through, my analysis, based on no information but common sense, is it would be really good for people who provide information like that which you provide, because not only are we captive, but I don't even know if you saw this piece, a great piece in the Columbus Monthly, wherever the hell that is. I think it's probably Ohio or something, where this woman writes a great story about how she was the family chef, and all of a sudden, because of you,
her husband of 34 years or something became obsessed with cooking and flavors and whatever, and essentially took over the leadership kind of thing. I'm guessing that's not that aberrational for 13 months of lockup, no?
Yeah, I think, well, I don't want to get too philosophical, but I do think, I've always felt, cooking is about transformation at its heart, because if you become a good cook, you feel better about yourself. You're doing something with your hands. It's incredibly rewarding. As someone said, you know, cooking is one of those great arts because it disappears quickly.
Yeah.
You know, which I think is wonderful. You can't hang it on the wall. I guess you could, but spaghetti doesn't last too well on the wall. But I do think it's transformational because people, your family, your friends, being a good cook is a really big deal.
Yes.
And so there are very few things you can do in life now where you're doing something with your hands. You're doing something that's a craft. You know, I can't fix my car anymore. That went out 20 years ago. And you're also doing it for other people. How many things do we do for other people with our hands that, you know, is so wonderful in so many ways? Mm. And also, you have to eat. I mean, it's not a, this is not a silly pastime. This is a core thing to do. So again, it's about transformation. And your story you just mentioned is about transformation, right?
Yeah, it is.
You know, one last thing, Christopher, that I wonder, whether pandemic or before the pandemic, do you have any idea whether it's the husband cooks and the wife cleans or vice versa, or if people often cook together in couples? And clean together in couples. Do you have anybody ever looked into that as far as you know?
I'm absolutely against cooking together. Sorry.
Really? Tell me why.
No. He's well, because here's the thing. Like if my wife cooks, I'll clean. If I cook, you know, she'll clean.
Okay.
But I like to be in a space where I it's my space.
Yeah.
And I can cook at my speed. I can just tune the rest of the world out. Once you get into a partnership around cooking, unless each of you is doing a different recipe, that's fine. But doing the same recipe.
Yeah.
Like I have a great marriage, but I'm not sure it would endure cooking the same recipe with two people. I think
wait,
that would
be Christopher and Kimball, what are you talking about? Every time I see you on TV in a foreign land, you're working with some great chef. From that community,
we're talking about marriage here.
Oh, okay,
marriage.
Yeah. Okay, fine.
Yeah, marriage.
Okay,
okay.
I just want to make sure. So, can we talk about the cookbook for a little bit?
Sure.
Tell people what the. By the way, just like when you did Cookish, I did make a recipe last night, so I can talk to the listeners about whether or not this works. I'll leave people in suspense for a second. What's the guiding principle behind this one? Tuesday nights. Mediterranean.
Well, I think Mediterranean in some way has been hijacked by the health movement. So you think about grilled fish and a glass of Sancerre and some fruit for dessert, right?
Yeah.
In other words, it's Southern European. It's Southern France, really. Well, okay, that's part of the story. But Mediterranean is a very big place, and it does actually include North Africa. You know, it's got Libya, Morocco, and Tunisia, and Egypt. It's got the Fertile Crescent. It's got Turkey and, you know, Lebanon and Syria, and Greece and Malta. So it's a big place, and there's a lot of very different traditions there. So we wanted to do a book that actually represented Mediterranean food, which is all the cultures that are on the Mediterranean. And that's a very different thing than saying just health food, because it is healthy, but we're not afraid of fat, right? I mean, it has meat in it. It's a very natural way of cooking. It's relatively simple, a lot of spices, lots of big flavors. So there's a lot of common ground there, but it's not, you know, this is not LA for the $40, you know, piece of halibut, you know, with a little bit of salsa on top. This is real food.
But there are also sections, which I found very appealing. Fast, faster, and fastest.
Yes.
Fill in the blanks for us there.
Well, we divided the recipes into three categories, and, you know, from 45 minutes or so down to the fastest, which is probably definitely under half an hour. And again, you know, speed. Look, everybody understands that people don't have a ton of time. We probably had more time in the last year than we've had forever. But getting food on the table in a reasonable amount of time is something we all have to do. The luxury is, of course, having all day to cook. So we divided the recipes by time into three categories. And, you know, at Mill Street, we have to be very cognizant of the fact that the real people in real kitchens cooking food, and we have to make it easier for them to get there.
So, Christopher Kimball, when Cookish came out, you probably don't recall this, but I told you I made a recipe. I think it was broccolini with ground pork or something.
And it was. You told me about it. You talked about it for days.
You didn't know what you were talking about, if you recall. And I decided to dramatically adjust the proportions. I don't know.
It worked out really well, Jim, right?
It was atrocious. It was inedible. It was inedible. And I decided, because I was moderately embarrassed, that maybe you did know what you were talking about. So I proceeded to, immediately after I had to throw out the first batch, make it exactly as you suggested, and it was terrific. Last night I made, in the fastest category, the pasta with lemon pesto, which I have to say is not only one of the easiest things I've ever made, which is, I assume, one of the reasons is in the fastest category, it's also one of the most fabulous tasting things I've ever made. Where does that come from? Where does that come from?
Well, those in the Amalfi region, in Italy, they grow these lemons that are just humongous. I was there a few years ago. My editor was there actually not too long ago. And a lot of dishes end up obviously using lemons, including a lot of pasta dishes. So years ago, I had lemon on pasta, and I thought, well, that's kind of a weird combination.
That's what I thought coming in.
Yeah, me too. And then we were there and had it and went, oh, okay, now I get it. Now that this works. So it's how you do it. But that's where it comes from. It comes from a wild thing.
You know, one of the things that I was naive about is you, in the water.